Welcome to Art Bell Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from October 27th, 1999.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening and or good morning, wherever you may be across this great land of ours, from the Tahitian and Hawaiian Islands out west, eastward to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands, south into South America, north all the way to the pole and worldwide on the Internet, thanks to the auspices of... of course, the good people at broadcast.com that distribute for us. And, of course, the Intel Corporation has come up with this wonderful codec that allows you to go to my website, download the G2 program. You're going to want to do that. Believe me, go back, put it into your computer, come back to the website, left hand. Actually, now it's on the main page. Just click on streaming video, and you can not only see, but you can hear the show underway. It'll be abbreviated by 1 hour tonight. We've got a lot to do. I'm going to kick out of here about 1 hour early so I can get a little bit of sleep before the airplane ride. It should be a real ride. We're all hams. Alan Corbett, Bob Crane, and myself, we're all hams, and we're all going to have handhelds on the airplane. And Powell says we're allowed to play with them, so... we're going to be, the plane will leave Fortuna at about 6 a.m., Fortuna, California, on its way to Medford, Oregon. You might sort of decide if you're anywhere within, be high up in the air, 29,000 feet, so we should have a good signal. Leaving Fortuna at about 6 in the morning for Medford, Oregon, and then leaving Medford, I don't know, shortly thereafter, to arrive in Pahrump, Nevada. You can kind of draw a line here if you want to. Between 9 and 9.30, leaving probably closer to 10 o'clock. Then we'll fly over the Mesquite area. We'll fly over Cheyenne, Wyoming, land in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and then on to Mackinac Island. In the second half hour, I have an interview with Jane Seymour. In the first half hour, I've got confirmation of a monstrous story that I sort of teased you with yesterday. Peter Davenport, in the southern tier of the U.S., two heavy aircraft, both reported, flight crews, both reported a monstrous triangle moving at incredible speeds. That report and more coming right up. You heard about this last night on the program, and I know it's hard to believe, but two heavy aircraft in the southern tier of the U.S. sighted something incredible, and Peter passed it on to me tonight. Peter is here to validate for you what he told me last night. Peter, from the UFO Reporting Center in Seattle, welcome.
Thank you, Art. Nice to be back, as always. Yeah, we have a really interesting report for our listeners tonight. And since we have such limited time tonight, and since I know that you've already prepped your listeners not only tonight but last night as well, allow me, if you would, to go to the first cut, just 51 seconds long, of the first hint we received, that something unusual had happened yesterday morning over the southern United States. Let me just play this audio cut, and I think it'll give our listeners a good idea for what happened. And then we'll play the cut with the actual crew member who watched this object go by his plane.
All right.
But here's the first report we had yesterday morning.
On 2:45 in the morning, Tuesday morning, October 26th, had a couple of sightings from some air carrier pilots at 37,000 feet. And they've been instructed to call you in the next few days, and I'm sure they will. One of them's, both crew members saw the lights, three lights, and they were at their altitude, 37,000 feet, and they were coming at the aircraft and made a hard left turn to the object, made a hard left turn. The aircraft was about 30 miles south and saw the same thing. And hopefully they'll give you a call and give you their descriptions. There was a halo effect around the lights also.
All right, for the sake of the audience, obviously little snippets were missing from that, and folks, what we've done is eliminate the cities in question, because we still, at this point, don't want it known until there's further investigation precisely where it occurred.
That's exactly the case, and not only have we deleted the location there, Art, but that gentleman will identify as just a professional in the aviation industry.
Right.
Whether on the ground or in the air, military or civilian, we'll leave that up to the listener's imagination. But that was the first hint that we had that something unusual had happened yesterday morning. Now, if I may, let me just go to, this is about a three-minute cut of my conversation with one of the crew members who actually laid eyes on this thing. Towards the end of the cut, our listeners will be able to hear this gentleman's credentials as an aviator. But here we go, about a three-minute cut of the gentleman who saw this triangular object yesterday morning, the 26th of October, go right by not only his aircraft, but another aircraft that was about 100 miles to the north of them. They right. both saw this object. Here we go.
All right.
What we saw was three bright lights show up at about our 11 o'clock, about 37,000 feet altitude,
mm-hmm.
which was our current altitude. And they're extremely bright, a perfect triangular formation. You could see a faint light in between, a line, actually, in between the lights. And as we watched it moving from west to east, and this is over, the lights all of a sudden started fading and disappeared out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And just as they appeared, they disappeared. And we asked ATC, hey, is there anybody here? And there was nobody there except that about 100 miles away from us. And these lights were too bright to be any other airplane, especially from the rear end, because moving east, we had no lights that bright.
So it was overtaking?
It was actually about our 10 o'clock position, and it was moving east. Moving east pretty quick. By the time it faded, it was probably about our 11:30 position. It appeared to be right at our altitude, maybe slightly above it.
Mm-hmm.
We had to have watched it for at least a good minute and a half.
Uh-huh. And it disappeared from your sight just by fading out at your 11:30 position?
That's right. The lights just, from the brightness they were, all of a sudden they started dimming rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And then it disappeared. It was gone.
Yeah. Did you pick up anything on TCAS at all?
No, I had it up. Our TCAS is good to 40 miles out, and so I had it up, pulled it up instantly
mm-hmm.
to see if there was anything there. And there was nothing on our scope. And so I couldn't tell, well, if it's not within 40 miles, it's pretty large to be outside of 40 miles with lights that bright.
Yeah. Or else it didn't have a transponder on it.
That's true.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, yeah, so since 1981, I was a fighter pilot with the Air Force.
Uh-huh.
And since 1995, I've been flying. I've never seen anything like this before, and I've been up in areas where there's a possibility of seeing something strange, especially in the military, but
yeah.
I've never, ever seen anything like this.
Yeah. What'd you please?
I flew F-16s because we're going 0.8, so we're doing 0.8 Mach.
Mm-hmm.
And over the ground, we're probably doing 540 ground speed.
Mm-hmm.
And for it to move from our 10 to 11:30 at the short time had to be either a fighter moving at that speed or something else. The thing that got me was the size of it. The lights were so bright and the size of whatever it was so large.
Mm-hmm. I think it was as big as your clenched fist at arm's length.
Yes, and not being on TCAS at and thinking, well, that's got to be over 40 miles away or closer. I don't know. It's so large, you would think it would be fairly close to you.
So that object was between two aircraft that were an estimated 100 miles apart, Art.
Okay, and again, these are commercial heavy aircraft we're talking about without identifying what they were.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Both headed eastbound towards the East Coast, different destinations, 100 miles apart. They're talking to one another on the radio. They see this object with three lights on it, and the lights were extraordinarily bright, this gentleman reported to us, streaking from their 10 o'clock position. The aircraft on the southernmost aircraft saw it coming, and apparently, according to one gentleman, it made a turn, and then it streaked by this aircraft, going from this aircraft's 10 o'clock position to 11:30 position in about a minute. And then the lights just faded out like turning the lights down with the rheostat.
So that thing was really moving.
It must have been. The interesting thing, this gentleman, I asked him whether, and you heard this in his statement, I asked him whether he could cover it with his thumbnail held at arm's length, and he said, no way. He said, it was as big as my fist held at arm's length.
Mm.
That is 10 degrees of arc subtended, and the object appeared to be large to the crews of both aircraft. So it was at least 40 or 50 miles from each aircraft, and it appeared large, and it covered about 20 degrees, maybe 30 degrees from their vantage point in about 1 minute.
Boy, it's not that frequently you get two commercial crews reporting something as serious as that. People better sit back and think about what's going on here. I said this to you, I think, earlier today, and you said, the amount of reports I'm getting, you said, Art, I think these may be the last days, is of what I think you said, Peter.
That's the biblical interpretation, or what the Quran says. I hope I'm wrong, Art. I really do. But
it's that serious, that busy?
It's pretty busy. It fluctuates from day to day, of course. But yesterday was very busy. This is what our listeners have heard is only one report of the five reports we had, five major reports, four of which were reporting triangular, very large triangular-shaped objects.
Mm-hmm.
We took also another report from the state of Mississippi, very good report from a gentleman who is a commercial pilot. He's a ham radio operator. He and his sons were standing outside at 2312 Central Daylight Time last night, Tuesday night, and they saw a very, very large object come at them.
We've got time. Go ahead.
Shall I play this?
Yeah,
time?
Go ahead.
This is a very good one, and I would like to play this. This guy, he has had a UFO report in the past, but he elected not to report it. He's sort of a humble guy, despite his credentials. Let me just go to this. Oh, it's about a two-minute report of what was seen over the state of Mississippi last night. I'll let this guy speak for himself. Here we go.
You had a whole bunch of landing lights on it. But, so I just stood there and watched. And it looked to be about 1,500 feet northbound. And it stopped and hovered momentarily.
Mm-hmm.
This thing was huge. And I mean huge. Looked to be about the size of probably a DC-10. What was so strange about it didn't make any noise whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Me and my boys went out. We were outside. We're kind of out in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, everything's real quiet. Start to finish, a good, I'd say a good 3 minutes. But at the angle that I was looking at it, I know for a fact that it stopped and hovered.
Okay.
And it was only brief, and then it continued on its northerly course. It was triangular shaped in a sense. I couldn't tell the total outline,
mm-hmm.
but the marking system of this, whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
It had nothing but white lights on it.
Okay.
And we had time to go in and get your binoculars and come back out. And it looked like rows of smaller white lights.
Rows of small lights on it, and you just had one large blinking light?
And had one tremendous, it was just tremendous, large white blinking strobe light.
Okay.
One large white strobing light right in the center of it,
right,
while it hovered in the night sky over the state of Mississippi. This was last night. This was just about 24 hours ago.
Peter.
Yeah, it's very interesting. We're going to have these reports posted to our website and many, many others, probably about 200 new reports, probably on Sunday when our webmaster gets back in town and people will be able to see with their own eyes what has been reported to us over our website in the recent past.
All right. We are way short on time, so I'm going to say donations to the National UFO Reporting Center are welcome and needed. That's what keeps them alive up there, folks. You would simply send a check or a few bucks to the National UFO Reporting Center, P.O. Box 45623, University Station, in Seattle, Washington, zip code 98145. And I'll repeat that one more time. The National UFO Reporting Center, P.O. Box 45623, University Station, Seattle, Washington, 98145. And if you have something going on immediately, something happening now, there is a hotline number for you to call. It is area code 206-722-3000. It's good 24 hours a day. Peter isn't, but it is. That's area code 206-722-3000. Peter, as always, incredible. And the follow-up on this, I would like to talk, if you can get one of those crew members to come on and do an interview, I'd like to do that.
He has already consented to that. He is traveling now. He'll be back home very soon, and I think we'll do that, and some other people as well who have equally interesting stories to tell, Art.
All right. Well, then, bless your heart, Peter. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to get this information out tonight.
Good night. All right. Well, folks, you think about it. What you just heard was a heavy airline crew member, and but one of two that saw it. All right, once again, in the morning, we're going to get our house sitters all comfortable here, the people who sit the house while we're gone, and then we're going to fly away. And Bob Crane and myself and Alan Corbett all are amateur radio operators, and we are going to be monitoring the following frequencies, 146.52 on the 2-meter band, 146.52 simplex, and on UHF, 446 simplex. The plane will leave Fortuna at about 6 in the morning, if all goes well, arriving in Medford sometime later, then taking off for Pahrump, Nevada, landing here in Pahrump, 9 to 9:30, somewhere in there, leaving about 10. We'll then fly over Mesquite, Cheyenne, Wyoming. We'll stop in Sioux Falls, South Dakota for a little liquid refreshment for the airplane. And then on to Mackinac Island in Michigan. So you can kind of look at that flight path. That's the just now filed flight plan. And if you've got a radio and you're a ham, you might try and get hold of us somewhere along that line. We'll arrive in Mackinac Eastern time at about 6 in the evening. Of course, you lose about 3 hours on the way. There is a very serious flu story that I'm going to get to at the top of the hour. And coming up after the break, you did it, or we did it, but I miraculously got hold of Jane Seymour, who starred in the movie Somewhere in Time with Christopher Reeves, the movie that has propelled me to make this airplane flight to Mackinac Island and the Grand Hotel. And somehow, some way, magically, this morning at about 10 a.m., I got to interview Jane Seymour. That interview is coming up shortly, so you're not going to want to miss it. It's really going to be absolutely excellent. Jane Seymour from Somewhere in Time coming up. Also, of course, Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from October 27, 1999.
And she knows I'd love to love her, but she lets me down every time. Can't make her mine. She's no one's lover tonight with me. She'll be so. Love me.
listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from October 27, 1999.
Welcome, everybody. In a moment, an interview coming up with none other than Jane Seymour, co-star of the Somewhere in Time movie that I'm going to go pay tribute to in Mackinac Island tomorrow morning. Tomorrow, actually. So, Jane Seymour just around the... Oh, by the way, if you'll check my website right now and my webcam, you'll see the picture of Jane Seymour that in that movie made Christopher Reeves and nearly anybody else who looks at it fall very much in love with her. That's on my webcam right now. We'll be right back. Jane Seymour.
Hi.
Hi. You don't know me, but I love you. I'm going back now to a line in the movie that I'm calling to talk to you about, Somewhere in Time.
Right.
And I remember Christopher Reeves sitting there, standing there actually, and practicing lines that he was going to use on you when he finally met you. You've had so many successes. Emmys, Golden Globes, of course, your incredible series, Dr. Quinn. So many successes, and yet I call you tonight to talk about Somewhere in Time.
Yeah.
I don't know how you feel about that movie, but I must tell you, I believe in the concept of soulmates. Do you?
I absolutely do. And, you know, when we were making that movie, it was a magic that happened to everybody. It was an extraordinary movie. It only cost about $2 million to make.
Oh, my.
It was never properly released because Universal had the Blues Brothers $40 million movie coming out the same week, and they sort of didn't even notice we existed. And there was an actor's strike that time, and we weren't allowed. Chris and I were not allowed to publicize the movie. And we were just so frustrated because we loved this movie. And I'd conned my friend John Barry into doing the music for nothing. And subsequently, you know, he would own the rights afterwards. And, of course, he made more money, I think, from that ultimately than any of the other things. So it was sort of a labor of love. And it was a very special movie when we made it. There were no cars allowed on the island, so we were all issued with bicycles. And
I think that remains the case today,
I believe so. But it was just, there was something special about the making of it. And the whole crew, in fact, probably one of my closest friends in the world today, is one of the associate producers from that movie. So a lot of us have really kept in touch, and I'm still, of course, very much in touch with Christopher Reeve. And it's just so wonderful to both Chris and I to realize that something that touched our hearts has touched so many people's hearts.
And so much later. In other words, when it came out, it wasn't that big. And today, let me tell you, when I met my wife, it's the first movie that I sat her down and that we watched together.
Oh.
And we were so moved by it and we're so in love that we're making the trip to the Grand Hotel in Mackinac. As a matter of fact, we're leaving in the morning on a jet plane.
I'm so envious. You know, I was intending to go this year and I had all the plans ready to go. And then, of course, at the last minute, I had to do a CBS movie. And, of course, they didn't want to wait till that Somewhere in Time weekend is over. They wanted it now.
Of course
they do. So I didn't have any choice, really, because I have to work when I get the work.
In my studio, directly behind me right now, I have a picture and have had for a long time of Elise. And I have never in my life, Jane, seen a more beautiful, classic, fall-in-love-with-instantly face.
Wow.
It's absolutely lovely, as are you. Now, when you did that movie, I talked to Stephen Simon. I've interviewed him a couple of times now, and he told me a really interesting story about your coming in costume. Did you really do that?
Well, you know, what I used to do is I used to go in for interviews and things, and people would say, well, you know, we can see how you look, but could you play such and such? And so a long time ago, I thought the smart thing to do would be to show up, not looking like I was in costume, but wearing clothes that were as close to the character as I could get away with while still pretending to be in street clothes. So that's what I did.
Well, when you walked in the room, Stephen said, everybody looked at everybody and said, that's the end of that. It's her. She's one. Now, I also believe that love, I've been kind of toying with the idea of time travel all my life. It has fascinated with me, been a fascination with me. And I think love is the one thing that actually might do it, if anything ever does, because it's got to be the strongest force on Earth.
I would agree with that. And, you know, I think there are so many things we really don't understand. I mean, we know there are so many parts of our brain and of our psyche and of our souls that we can't pinpoint down, that I think it's entirely possible. And I especially believe that we want to believe that love transcends time and place.
That's right.
And I know in my heart, for example, my father passed on many years ago. I feel he's right there with me. I mean, every day I find myself at one point thinking of him and kind of almost asking him, what do you think? You know, and my love for him has never dwindled, despite the fact that he isn't here in body anymore.
No, but so you can feel him there, can't you?
I feel him there. I mean, he definitely inspired Dr. Quinn for me for 7 years. I mean, every day I'd walk on that set and I felt he was right there. And I thought, what a coincidence that his passion for medicine, for his history of medicine, should, you know, suddenly turn into this amazing series that was so wonderful for me for so many years.
I would lay a wager with anybody that if Somewhere in Time were released today, it would be a smash hit. Huge hit.
Well, you know what? I went to Universal and I said, are you crazy? You can make some good money here. And I think they did their research and they found that they probably could, but what they wanted to do was to try and see if we could come up with a sequel. And I don't know how they can come up with a sequel. I think what they would do that would be much better would be to re-release the original and really do a campaign around it, because it's never really been given the opportunity in this country of being shown as a feature.
Oh, quite right. I keep telling people.
And I think there's a lot of people who've seen it, you know, hundreds of times, that would enjoy the experience of going and watching it. The same way that, you know, in a different way, people like going to see the Rocky Horror Picture Show or a Star Wars movie or something. But this is the ultimate romantic movie, and people I know watch it 15, 20 times, you know, and they really enjoy the experience of sitting there and taking it in. It's not a question of, well, I've seen that, you know, I know the story.
I have seen it that many times. I really have. What was it like? Now, I've never been to Mackinac Island, nor have I been to the Grand Hotel. What's it like there?
It's quite beautiful. Of course, I haven't been there in 20 years, but I'm told now that it's even more extraordinary than when I was there. Of course, you know, Chris and I weren't able to stay at the Grand Hotel because there was no room there. We had to stay in some other,
oh my,
not particularly nice little hotel down the road. So we just got to film there. But it is a spectacular hotel. I'm told that it's almost like a shrine to Somewhere in Time now. They have they play the movie there all the time, and they have gift shops with things to do with Somewhere in Time. And
oh, yes.
It's really become like quite a little mecca, I think.
I'm going to be blessed with seeing it on the big screen at the hotel for the first time.
Oh, wow. That has to be amazing. I think I've only ever seen it once on the big screen.
Were you aware that in the book from which the movie came, Bid Time Return, they used in the book the Hotel del Coronado? Which was amazing to me. I picked up the book the other day and began to read it, and I said, wow, different hotel altogether.
Absolutely. I think the reason that they changed was because when you see the setting of Mackinac Island, you'll see it's just time stops still there. It's just an amazing place. You're on an island, and it's isolated, and they've really protected that island.
So you have stayed in touch with Christopher.
Yes, I actually spoke to him about 4 days ago.
How is he?
He's doing great. He's very excited about the progress that they're having with the American Paralysis Association, which his foundation has merged. They've got, they're going to be starting human trials, I believe, this year.
So he continues
for spinal regeneration.
In his lifetime.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're starting this year. It's amazing. I mean, the big push right now, he said, is it's a question of how much money they can raise. The more money they can raise, the sooner they can find a cure to this, because they have the scientists, they have the experiments, they have the people who are willing to be the guinea pigs. And you know, they've proven it in laboratory testing with animals that it does work, and so now it's a question of doing it on human beings.
It's odd. When I look at Christopher today, he doesn't look different. His face, he still looks like the same Christopher, and If he were to be back on his feet, I don't know that I'd see the difference.
No, I mean, he looks amazing. And what's amazing about him, though, is he's just inspirational. And I had a conversation with him once about, you know, obviously no one would ever choose to have this horrible thing happen to him the way that it did. But of all the people in the world that I know, he is able now to do more with his life in a funny way than he would have done if this had never happened to him. I mean, he really is changing. He's changing history in terms of medical research, and because no one had ever considered it was possible to do anything to the spine. It was one area that they'd all given up on. And he is the one that's made that happen. He's changing the world for people who have disabilities. He's really fighting in government for rights for people. And he's become an extraordinary activist. And he really also, I think, has become an inspiration for everyone in the world, that when you think things are tough for you, you think about
that's right.
The fact that he, not only is it tough for him just to survive moment by moment, but he is going out of his way with what energy he has to help other people. And it makes you realize that that really is probably the key to happiness, is that when you can do something for someone else, it takes it away from, you know, from whatever you feel is not right about your life.
Quite right. What was the chemistry like between the two of you during that movie? It was such a romantic movie.
I think, you know, one day a book will have to be written on that. those of us who were there know there was a magic, and there has always been a magic. Chris and I, you know, we were really totally overcome by this movie, and
yes.
A very long-term, wonderful love we really had for each other and still do have. And it's wonderful because our spouses are very understanding and happy about this. So, you know, it's he's just a very special person, and something magical happened, and he just, we felt very strongly about each other.
Jane, when you read the part of Elise McKenna, did you know right away?
Oh, yes. And I read it. I just said, I have to play this role. And I was so superstitious about not getting it that on the day that I went in for the final interview and I actually met Chris, I got into my car, and a girl that I barely even knew, a sort of semi-girlfriend, said, I'm turning 40 and I'm freaking out. Will you please take me far, far away so I can go on a beach and... And so I went off to this faraway beach. I don't even know where I was. I was incommunicado all day. By the time I got back, the phones had been ringing off the hook. Everyone was trying to leave messages to tell me that I'd got this part, and I'd completely forgotten. Because, you know, I'd decided to dedicate the rest of the day to helping this girl get through what she thought was going to be a big trauma for her.
Well, you know, it going back to if it were released today, I would love to see it re-released, because there are so many people who would benefit from the love in that movie.
I think it would be great, you know, without with the internet and everything, if people got together and made a campaign to ask Universal to re-release it, maybe it would happen. I mean, amazing things were happening.
Oh, let's do it.
But I think that's one that I think is really worth, if people really feel that strongly about it, and I don't think you're alone. I know, for one, General Colin Powell, it's his favorite movie of all time.
Well, you know, I think you're right. There really could not be a sequel to it. It is what it is, and it would never be improved on.
And you know, when I watched Titanic, and you know, in the hugeness, I mean, the extraordinariness of Titanic, I kept thinking to myself that Somewhere in Time was in some ways even more moving, and yet it was a small movie. But there was something really, the same magic that Titanic had, Somewhere in Time has.
Plus, no movie.
You need a big ship.
And I'm a big movie fan, Jane, but that movie, nothing has ever moved me like that movie, and I can't even really explain it. It's just, it's something to my very core that was affected, so.
I'll tell you something very interesting, a piece of trivia that you probably don't know, is that when it came out in the Far East, in Hong Kong specifically, they were going to play it for 2 weeks, and it played for over a year to packed houses.
Wow.
And Sir Run Run Shaw, who owns the theater chain out there, said, I didn't understand why. So he invited me out, and I met him, and he wanted to see, you know, was it me? Why was this film doing so well? And in the history of Chinese cinema, never since Gone with the Wind had anything played so consistently. And he took it off when it was still playing to packed houses and put it back on again 6 months later, and it packed them out again. So he said they've never had a film that did that.
That's remarkable.
Yeah.
And you're remarkable. You have a very, very busy schedule, don't you, of shooting?
Yeah, right now it's pretty crazy. We're doing a movie for CBS called Murder in the Mirror, and I'm in every shot, and James is directing it and producing with Larry Thompson, and I'm filming every day for 18 days. So
I've done radio now for a decade, but that's like it's like falling off. You know, it's water off a duck's back. Nothing to me, but television. Oh, I've done it a couple of times, and oh my, that's a lot of work.
It's much harder and faster work than doing features. It's because you have to come up with the same quality and material in 18 days as opposed to 2 or 3 months. So I think when people come and watch us do it, they have no idea how hard and how fast everybody works on a television movie.
Oh, that's right. I interviewed Chris Carter last night, and he said he went and starred in one of his own series, and when he went in, he said, you know, I'm paying you all much too much. And when he left, he said, I'm not paying you anywhere nearly enough.
Right.
So
it's amazing, amazing how hard the work is. We just, James and I also just finished a wonderful movie that I think you and I think everyone who loved Summer in Time will love. And it's called Enslavement, The True Life Story of Fanny Kemble. And we just had a test screening for it in its very rough form on Monday, and it scored extraordinarily high. So I think there's a chance that it will be put out now as a feature film.
I'll look for it when.
And then, hopefully, and we're waiting to hear now, and then it will definitely be on Showtime afterwards.
On Showtime, all right. Well, I'm not going to miss it, as I don't miss a thing you do. Jane, I know you're busy, and I want to thank you, but one thing, there are a lot of people from all over the country and beyond getting ready to converge in the morning and Friday on Mackinac Island, and so you might have a word or two for them.
Well, I really wish I could be with all of them. I am so upset that I didn't get to make it this year. I've sent a brief video message, so hopefully they'll put that up on the screen for everybody. And I will be there. I will find a way to get there one of these years. And I just thank you all for being supporters of Somewhere in Time. And let's see if we can't get it re-released as a feature, because that would be so exciting for
yes.
us all to see it and to share it with this generation.
Yes, Jane, thank you so much.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
Jane Seymour, and what an interview, huh? That was really neat. It was really neat of her to do on such short notice. Now, I want to say again, if you want to see the picture that hangs in the history room of the Grand Hotel at Mackinac, I have taken a studio cam photograph of it, and I'm going to leave it up for, oh, I don't know, another half hour or so, but if you've never seen it, number one, go and rent this movie. Absolutely go out and rent this movie. It's called Somewhere in Time with Jane Seymour and Christopher Reeves. And then then remember what you have seen on my webcam. You just go to my website at www.artbell.com and go down the left-hand side to you see webcam and click on that. Silly love songs? Love silly? I don't think so.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from October 27th, 1999.
As bold as a knight should be, he rode an old gray mare called Bess, searching for a damsel in distress, just to see if he could set her free. See the knight in rusty armor. his side with a rusty blade. Up the tower steps he sneaks, but as he moves, his rusty arm sweeps. Such a mournful note. And all the sentries at their post thought it must have been the castle ghost. They jumped for their lives.
Premier Radio Networks presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired October 27, 1999.
You know, I first heard the name Stuart Wilde when somebody called me one day and said, "Hey, you stole Stuart Wilde's title, The Quickening." He wrote a book called The Quickening. And that's who's coming up in a few moments. With his indulgence, I do have a couple of things I've got to get on. Hour number one was amazing. We began with Peter Davenport, one of the crew members of the commercial heavy airliner, and two actually saw it, which in the southern tier of the U.S. saw a giant, a gigantic, fast-moving, triangular object. Two commercial aircraft crews, folks. So we did that in the first hour. And then in the second part of the first hour, we interviewed Jane Seymour, who co-starred in none other than Somewhere in Time. And as you may know, I'm an unbelievable fan of that movie. And so I'm going to bail out a little early because I'm on a plane in the morning for Mackinac Island. And actually, I'm going to give you a little bit, if I can find it here, of my itinerary. I had it here somewhere. Because we're going to have, we're all hams. Alan Corbett from the network. Bob Crane is a ham. And I'm a ham. So that's a lot of hams in one airplane, I'll tell you. And since it's a private plane, he'll let us play with our radios. So we're all going to have radios on two frequencies. You might write them down if you're a ham. 146.520 simplex on 2 meters, 146.52. And 446, 446 megahertz in 72 centimeter band. And so right, here's roughly what's going to occur. We're going to leave Fortuna at about 6 in the morning. Bob will. And head up, up toward Medford, Oregon. So from Fortuna to Medford, you can kind of plot that out on a map. And then they'll be leaving Medford for Pahrump, Nevada, my little town, arriving here probably around 9 o'clock in the morning, something like that. And so you can plot that out. And then we'll be leaving Pahrump, I don't know, after they juice up the airplane, probably 9:30, 10 o'clock, something like that. And we'll be flying over, to give you an example, Mesquite and Area 51. I wonder if we could fly over there. Probably not. Mesquite, and then on up to over Cheyenne, Wyoming. And we're going to make another juice stop, airplane juice, at Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And then from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, on to Mackinac Island, and with the three-hour loss, arriving there at about 6 in the evening. But all the way along the route, we'll be monitoring 146.52 and 446 simplex. And I thought I would just pass that on to all the hams out there. Might be a lot of fun. There's one other item that I've got to get on here. Actually, a couple. Looking at the news, I see it's a sweep, New York won. Congratulations, New York. And I want to find the witch that did it to Atlanta. Or was it Uri Geller? I don't know. Somebody did it to Atlanta. Actually, New York did it to Atlanta. Bradley and Gore had their talkathon, and it was in Armenia, something awful has happened. Gunmen seized Armenia's parliament in a torrent of automatic weapons fire that you can see on CNN. And they actually killed the prime minister and seven other politicians. Did it for the Constitution, did it for the patriotism, because they thought their country was going to hell, and that's not over yet. The Dress Marilyn Monroe wore when she sang Happy Birthday to President Kennedy,
sold today for $1.2 million. $1.2 million. But here's the biggie, and I'm sorry to have to report this to you, but it's on my website. You can confirm it up there, a Reuters story. I read you the electronic telegraph version, entitled Fear of Flu Epidemic Growing as Deadly Virus Spreads, a dangerous new strain of flu that could trigger a worldwide epidemic has broken out in Hong Kong. Now, this story is just now breaking. They say, like the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic that killed around 20 million people worldwide, the Hong Kong strain is believed to have jumped from pigs to humans. Wonder if there's a message there. Health officials were alerted after a 10-month-old girl was admitted to the hospital last month. 2 years ago, a strain of flu from chickens, you'll recall, killed 18 in Hong Kong. Though health officials are anxious not to cause a panic, they're warning that killer strains usually come from pigs or poultry. According to New Scientist, the girl was successfully treated, but her virus bears the molecular hallmarks of a strain from pigs. So you're going to definitely want to keep an eye on this story, and as recent as this is, I would doubt the flu shots have covered it for the year, but I don't know. I'm not a doctor, so what do I know? All right. I think that just about covers it. As I said, we'll be meeting our house sitters in the morning, getting them all in place, and then we're on the way to the local Pahrump Airport. And maybe you'll talk to us in midair. We'll be at 29,000, 33,000 feet somewhere way up there. All right, I want to thank Stuart Wild for his indulgence. He's coming up next. Well, I want to thank Stuart Wild for the indulgence. He's a teacher's teacher. He's a maverick, so I can identify with him. He's written 20 books. One of them is The Quickening, and as I mentioned at the top of the hour, I began to get a lot of calls saying, hey, you stole his book title. You stole The Quickening. And, of course, a lot of people don't realize that there are only so many book titles, and actually I did not. I sort of thought about it on the air when events caught up with me, and that's how I named that book, and then later found out Stuart Wild had also written a book called The Quickening, but he indeed has. He's here to talk about all kinds of things, many spiritual. He will address the UFO alien abduction question. I'm still not over the two airline crews on the heavies that saw this incredible triangular object. It's getting pretty strange out there. Peter on the phone earlier today told me, all right, you know, it's like the last days. That's from Peter Davenport. Here is Stuart Wild. Stuart, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Art.
You have written 20 books.
Yes, sir.
You must do nothing but.
I don't know. I just write quick.
Stuart, what do you know about, I'm just going to jump right into this because I know we're going to cover a lot of ground this morning, but you have really looked into this whole UFO alien abduction business from your perspective. By the way, you're Australian, but you're English, and you're not exactly fully English. What are you?
Half English, half Sicilian, and I live half in Australia and half in Europe, you know?
You're really half and half.
Yeah, I'm definitely half and half.
All right. We just had the most remarkable story in the first hour of the show about this triangle sighted by two commercial heavy airliner pilot crews, and these are people who really know what they're talking about. One of them was a prior F-16 pilot. There's something up there, Stuart. There's really something going on. There's no question about it. What do you make of it?
Well, my expertise has always been in these sort of interdimensional worlds, and I started flashing the skies some years ago a series of mathematical numbers, which many of your listeners would be familiar with, called the Fibonacci numbers.
You were flashing these at the...
Yeah, with a million candle watt lamp, you know? Because I was out in Australia, where I live some of the time, south of Sydney, and I was watching these movements in the sky. And I'd see something like fly, let's say 20 degrees left, stop, and then fly back again, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I just started flashing them. I was kind of playing around. And then bit by bit, like all of a sudden, these lights started flashing back. And then eventually it got to the point where the grays were like coming through my walls. And I believe that they're interdimensional rather than necessarily extraterrestrial.
Slow up. And back up. The grays were coming through your walls?
Yes, sir. Like just right in my bedroom, just standing there at the end of the bed, you know?
No, I don't. In other words, that's never happened to me. I've had several UFO sightings now, but nary a gray standing at the end of my bed. That bears a little bit of description now. I mean, when did that first happen?
Well, what happened was I was in London some years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, and I was just laying in bed reading at about 11 o'clock at night.
Right.
And I became aware of this gizmo that was spinning near my knee. And it was not a physical gizmo. It was in that etheric, subtle body state, that sort of trans-dimensional, almost invisible state.
Right.
But over the years, I've developed a sight of that state. So I can look at a person walking down the street, and I can see the etheric, their etheric reality, where their feelings are.
Right.
Anyway, this gizmo was by my knee, and I just whacked it with my hand. And as I whacked it, I realized there was a prod in the middle of it, and it kind of went, click. And suddenly this prod retracted inside the gizmo and it disappeared. But that's what triggered this whole process.
Brother, what do you think that was?
They can move. Like, you know, like our solid world, you know, we perceive it as solid, but then we're not moving at a high enough velocity to comprehend its non-solid state. And I think they're moving at a so much higher velocity to us that they can go from solid to not solid.
Velocity or vibration?
Yeah, vibration.
Vibration,
all
right.
What I was saying.
So in other words, it's your view that these may not be extraterrestrials necessarily, as in from light years away, but they may simply be with us right now, vibrating in a different way, in a different dimension.
The same way that ghosts can walk through the walls. So I was in a hotel in Ireland like 15 years ago in Wexford. And I was lying on my bed, it was 11 at night, and this woman appeared in my room. And she was wearing an old shawl, and she was kind of miserable looking. And she just walked straight through the cupboard and the closet and walked out into the hallway. Okay, that would be like a low energy or lower energy than, let's say, the greys, who can act proactively, can come in, change a room, do things. You know, so she's at one oscillation. Let's say she's running at 50,000 cycles a second, and the grays are running at 300,000 cycles a second. Do you follow me?
Yes, I do. And mainstream science follows you as well. Michio Kaku, Dr. Kaku, who I interview frequently, one of the great theoretical physicists we have today, says there are 10, and now he thinks possibly 12 dimensions. So it's not far-out stuff anymore, Stuart.
No, I mean, I'm a great follower of Kaku, and what he says is that our four dimensions rotate up to 10, and then they rotate up to 26. And so there's a possibility of there being 26 dimensions of hyperspace, which form, I mean, it's like cake. So like there's, I don't know, there's chocolate and there's cream, and then there's sponge, and then there's pastry, and then there's more chocolate, and more cream, and more sponge, and more pastry until you get up to 26, you know? So
well,
now Kaku, I mean, I have read every word that Kaku's ever written.
Oh, you have?
Yes, sir. I'm an absolute follower of that man's work, and I love him.
Well, good. You would almost have to be with your theories, because when you start talking about dimensional beings, a lot of Americans roll their eyes, and I'm sure Australians and the British do the same thing. They kind of roll their eyes. But the fact of the matter is, cutting-edge science is now saying it's more likely than not.
Yes, very much so. There was a crop circle, which I think Linda Moulton Howe mentioned on your show some while back at Avery this year, and it had 33 dots in it, and
that's
inside the dots were these raised cubes. Now, if you halve that circle and you drop it back, it actually rotates from 4 to 10 to 26. And I don't think anybody's seen that yet, but I just worked out the graphic of that. And I was inside that circle right at Avery in England near Wiltshire. And it is, in fact, precisely and exactly Kaku's 4, 10, 26 dimensions theory in a crop circle, like 400 yards from the pub at Avery, you know?
What do you think crop circles are, Stuart?
Well, I don't know. I've been going there now for several years. And the best theory that anybody's come up with, and you've spoken to all the great experts, and I haven't, but, you know, there are so many films of these lights moving in the fields. They're not vortices of wind. They're not people wandering around with planks and pieces of string and so on, although there are certainly fake crop circles. They are definitely some kind of energy force that is pushing upon the crop. And if you walk in the crop circles, they're just bent over. They're not broken.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're talking in mathematical terms, not far from the Avery crop circle this year, which was the most astounding crop circle there's ever been, was another one that actually portrayed Necker's cube. And Necker's cube, as I'm sure many of your listeners would know, is a cube that turns itself inside out. So when you look at Necker's cube, it's a regular cube, and if you pull the back corner of it, it flips inside out. And so it's a way of, like, talking to people in these geometric fractal terms. And I've got a feeling that the whole UFO thing comes from that same idea, you know?
Yes, but why make it cryptic? In other words, if they are messages intended for us, and I'm not sure that's what you're saying, why make it cryptic? Why not write straighten up and fly right or else, or, you know, whatever?
Well, you know Jacques Vallée, who I'm sure you're familiar with, wrote Messages of Deception.
Yes.
And he said it's a control mechanism. You know, there is an authority in another dimension that is establishing some kind of perceptual change in humanity. So, okay, if you fly 15 UFOs onto the White House lawn, you panic everybody silly.
Yes.
But if you fly these various bits and bobs and you get everybody thinking, there'll be loads of people who say, like, oh, wow, you're out, Bill, you're out of your mind, you know? Or like Stuart Wilde, you're totally out of your mind.
Yep.
And then there's other people that are looking at these geometric patterns and saying, wait a minute, Kaku's, you know, 4, 10, 26 dimensions are in a crop field in Wiltshire.
Actually, Stuart, I think that if they landed on the South Lawn of the White House, the Clinton White House, nobody'd believe it anyway.
Exactly. They wouldn't. So I think it's a bit like, you know how you could have something that's very dogmatic and very sort of bullheaded, and they'll change, but they'll only change ever so slightly, ever so slowly, you know?
Well, I don't think it'd change Clinton.
Yeah.
Well, listen, hold on, Stuart. We're at the bottom of the hour. This is a shortened a segment, of course, because I had to get a lot in. I'm Art Bell, and once again, if you want to get a brief look at the picture to fall in love with, it's on my webcam, and I'll leave it there for about another half hour, and then I'll turn it on live. But do take a look. Jane Seymour. It does not get any more classic than that. My guest is Stuart Wilde, and he'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from October 27th, 1999. listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from October 27th, 1999.
Stuart Wilde is here. He's written 20 books, one of them called The Quickening. So the world comes full circle, and I get to interview Stuart. Running with the night is what we're doing. Good morning, everybody. We'll get right back to it. Horrid little story about this new flu strain just breaking in the last few hours is on my website as well. And you can read all about Stuart Wilde as well. We've got listings for, I think, the majority of his 20 books up there. So just scroll on down into the guest area, and you'll be able to hop over to Amazon.com and buy one or check one out or do whatever you want to do. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, Stuart Wilde. Stuart, welcome back. I've got to take it back for a second. I just can't leave alone this gray thing. Not everybody, Stuart, has seen a gray. Now, was the gray that you saw, one or several, I don't know, were they, for example, like the photographs that we've seen from Whitley Strieber of what, or pictures of what a gray looks like? I mean, were they typical? Were they any different? Can you describe what you saw?
Yeah, I mean, very similar to that picture, except they were more diaphanous, you know, like you could sort of almost see through them. And on occasions I've seen one, on occasions I've seen several, and on occasions I felt them in the room, but I couldn't actually see them. So one night I finished a recording session, because I make records as well, and actually it was in Bath, England, where your last guest, Jane, has a house, right?
Yeah, oh yes.
And I was in the hotel, this beautiful hotel, and it was 1 o'clock in the morning, and this thing came through the door, and the whole room went milky, but not like you could see it milky, it just felt very thick. And outside the hotel were these cobbled stones that have been there since like the 16, 1700s. And when a car goes over the cobbled stones, you can really hear it. And the whole place went really, really silent. And this character was standing between the bed and the door. And I said to the character, something rude, you know, which I can't repeat on the radio right now.
It's all right.
But it ends with off, anyway.
Yeah, I'm really tired,
you know?
Yes.
And, like, it withdrew, and the whole energy of the room changed. But in the morning when I woke up, which was about 5-6 hours later, I had these two snake bites on my arm.
Snake bites?
Yeah, they're like two pinpricks. And they were bleeding. And the blood would not coagulate. And I rubbed it off, and it carried on bleeding. Not bleeding profusely, but just minutely, you know?
Yes.
But it'd be like a red dot, and it wouldn't coagulate for 3 days.
Oh,
so, just screaming obscenities at them doesn't work. But that was just one of the occasions when, like, they just appeared in my room. And what I believe is that they have this trans-dimensional ability, and that they watch certain people. I don't know what the selection process is necessarily, you know. I don't know that necessarily if you are selected that's any great, wonderful thing, you know, because a lot of people have been very frightened and freaked out, you know.
As a matter of interest, before we move on, for a man who spent most of his time in Great Britain or Australia, or split between them, how do you know so much about my show?
Well, I listen to it on the internet in the morning, because I get up about 5 o'clock in London and I write.
I see.
So I boot up into your show.
I see.
And while I'm writing, I'm listening to it, because you're on the air when I'm actually writing in the morning.
I see.
Yeah.
When did the news reach you, Stuart, that I had written a book called The Quickening? Because I assume the emails probably went both ways.
A few people emailed me to let me know. I mean, I don't know when your book came out, but was it like about 9 months or a year ago or something?
Oh, longer than that.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago.
Was it? Yeah.
Three,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's no big deal. I don't mind. And also, I'm sure you're aware that nobody can copyright a title.
Right.
So if you and I decide to write a book called Gone with the Wind, there's nothing anyone can do about it, you know what I mean?
Well, so, I assure you I did not consciously steal your book title.
Absolutely, no, you didn't, Art, you know. And if I borrowed somebody else's title, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, there's lots of books out there that have similar titles or the same titles, and I know the intends to to, you know, to steal a title intentionally, because that's just, you know, it'd be silly to do, you know.
Maybe we're going to talk a little bit about The Quickening. And I have not read your version.
Yeah, and I haven't read yours. I tried to figure out how to get it, but I didn't know where to actually go for it, you know?
Amazon.com.
All right, okay. So, so next time I'm back home, I'll order it.
But Mike, let me give you just a brief sort of outline of my book, The Quickening, and it may not be at all related to what you wrote, since we both don't know. As a talk show host, early in my career doing politics and then later doing the paranormal, which I've been doing now for about a decade or better, I began to discern, reading the news every single night, that things were beginning to speed up. Political things, social things, environmental things. Every aspect of human endeavor seemed to be quickening. Events seemed to be quickening, heading toward some sort of event. Not necessarily the end of the world, mind you, but some sort of event that we're headed toward something. And that was that doesn't do justice to it, but it's the basis of the idea and the reason I picked that title.
And that's exactly what I was coming to in my book as well.
Really?
That, yeah, that, like, things are moving so quickly. And I wrote a book that a lot of my fans and readers know called Whispering Winds of Change.
Yes.
And what I said in that was that the world has kind of split into two evolutions. That it began with flower power in the 60s, and that was like, okay, albeit very simplistic, but it was like an evolution of consciousness, awareness, you know, wanting to be informed, you know, more independent type of thinking. And another evolution has sort of turned inwards.
Yes.
It's like an ingrown toenail. And it's becoming, you know, more regressive, more fascist, more controlling.
Yes.
And there are two different evolutions going on in the world today.
You're right.
And I talk about that in Whispering Winds of Change, and I talk about it also in The Quickening. But there's a lot of people out there who want information. They're just not going to watch a whole bunch of contrails go over their head and think, wow, I wonder what that is. You know, they want to know, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and that's what's changed in America, and it's definitely happening in Britain and Australia as well. People are not passive anymore.
Well, you allude also to the growing number of UFO sightings. It's actually, it's going berserk right now, and you have some thoughts, I think, on what it all means, why we're seeing all of these things now.
Well, one of the things that I'm almost convinced of, Art, is that over the years, you know, people like yourself, you know, you're teachers, and you're like, you're spiritual in a way, because you make people stop and think. As people have become more aware, they're moving again into this transdimensionality without actually realizing they're doing it. You know, their life may not be heaps different, but they're moving across. They're beginning to bridge between one dimension and the next. My particular expertise is like the subtle body, the etheric body, I call it. And, you know, we live in both bodies, the physical body and this subtle body. Now, I can walk down the streets of San Francisco and I can watch a person's etheric body. And many people can do that. And it doesn't take a great gift from God or great psychic abilities. It actually only takes the ability to develop your peripheral side vision, you know?
Well, I've never seen one.
Well, I tell you, if I ever get with you for a day, I can show it you.
And
it's only on the side of your eye.
When you see their etheric body, what are you able to discern from it?
Well, it's this absolutely unbelievably quick-moving energy. It's like a zillion flashes of lightning. But in the etheric is a human's feeling. So you can tell how they feel at that precise moment. Sad, happy, down, regressing, progressing.
Right.
Ashamed, uplifted, guilty, not guilty. You know, those feelings, you basically see the feelings.
Sick or healthy?
Yeah, sick or healthy. But, like, you can look at somebody and you can say, wow, I know that they've got a problem with their prostate, but you cannot do a medical diagnosis. Do you follow me?
I do.
But I'll tell you how it works, okay? In the center of your eye are some cells that are known as cones, and they're very good for forward vision.
Right.
But on the side of your eye are the rods, and the rods are very, very, very sensitive. And that's why you can't see the etheric just by looking at it. It's almost like you've got to tilt your head and kind of look at it with the side of your eye.
Well, I do know that in your peripheral vision, occasionally, you can see things that appear to move, but when you look at them, there is nothing. You only see it
Right.
Off, way off to the side, right. and so, sort of like a ghostly something.
That's exactly it, because your center vision, where the cones are for direct light, and the peripheral vision is for diffused light. So the rods on the side, it's easy to remember because it's C for cones and C for center, you know?
Sure.
So the cones are in the center of the eye and the rods are in the periphery. If you develop the rods, and everybody can do it, they've just got to practice. So what I tell people to do is put on a pair of sunglasses and tape them over
So
you can just see out the sides.
Oh, yes,
and
that would work.
And just walk around the house for an hour.
Bumping into things.
Yeah, well, no, don't hurt yourself, but begin to be aware of what is to your left and what is to your right.
Right.
And you can activate those rods really quickly because they're not used to working that much because they're not used normally, you know? But once you use the rods, you can see it. You can see the etheric, like, you can see it around a tree, let's say, you know?
Is it, Stuart, a good thing? In other words, to develop this vision would enable you to begin to see things, I don't know, that you might not want to see about your friends, about your associates, business partners, that kind of thing?
Well, you know, the things you're going to see, you're going to see. And, hey, if your business partner is a dishonest person, you might as well know it now, rather than in 3 months' time when they disappear with $100,000 a month, you know?
That's true, yes. That's
so
true.
It's not like you're using a judgment, but anything that brings ordinary people to a higher awareness brings them out of the prison of ignorance. And we've been locked in that prison for thousands of years. So I've always fought for, like, awareness and individual freedoms. And I think that people have to fight for that. You know, you don't get meaning in your life, like, dropped in your head by God. You have to fight for meaning, you know, to make something meaningful happen in your life, helping people usually, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same with awareness. You don't get given awareness. And then some people, like the guests on your show, are, like, unbelievably psychic, unbelievably gifted, and they're doing something, you know, they're talking to people. So awareness to me is like the key to our humanity, because in the end it's love, you know?
Did you, when you saw these grays and these things appear to you, did you question your own sanity at all?
No, sir. No, I didn't.
Not at all?
No, I've done a lot of that work, and I don't mean to sound grandiose, but I've been there before. However, when I did get into a lot of trouble was when I actually got, spun around by them. So I was at my home in London where I had an office, and it was just an apartment that I used to go to write. I was laying down on a bed at 5 o'clock at the end of a day's work, and I was meditating, and one of the greys came through the wall, and it spun me around, not physically, but literally my etheric. I fell asleep, and I woke up, and when I woke up, my etheric legs were not where my physical legs are. They were off at right angles to my knees. When I got off the bed, I fell over.
Yeah, I wouldn't like that.
And I got completely spooked. I grabbed my computer and my writing equipment. I ran out into the road, and I was going home. And I looked up, and I saw nothing. I thought, wow, thank Christ there's nothing over the house. And then I got around one corner, and there was this silver 30-foot classic-looking disc shape just right over the house, just hovering like a leaf.
Oh, my.
Like at about 300 to 500 feet.
You know, your experiences really parallel pretty much those of Whitley Strieber.
I've read some of his books, not all of them.
Uh-huh.
But I think that if you try to penetrate their world, they penetrate your world, you know?
Well, that brings us to another topic about the Greys. Now, I've interviewed Dr. David Jacobs, who wrote The Threat.
He's a magnificent writer.
Dr. Jacobs does not think that the Greys are warm, fuzzy, little lovable creatures who have our best interests in mind.
No.
quite the contrary. And so I wonder what you think about
that. Well, I would follow his theory completely.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And what I did was, that when I, on one occasion when there was this Grey near my bed, I know this might sound incredibly strange, but it's the truth. I kind of went through its eye. And I was looking for its mind behind its eye. And it was blank. I mean, there was nothing
now,
there.
Now, how did you do that? Did you mentally reach out or physically reach out?
No, it's like moving with the force of your will through the eye of another person.
And did you say there was nothing there?
There was nothing there. It was blank. Like, the thing was a complete drone. But beyond it, I saw this unbelievably horrendous, cruel, reptilian-type energy, which I don't know whether the greys are drones for the reptilians or the reptilians are just shape-shifting to make you scared or whatever, but it was spooky. But there's one more behind the reptilians after that, you know? And
so,
that's another group of beings altogether, so there's a whole hierarchy of them in there somewhere.
I've heard this from so many people.
Well,
I've seen Greys, and that they're a sort of a robotic in nature, a sort of a maybe part machine, part biological, and then there's, as you point out, the reptilians. And then what comes after the reptilians?
Well, the ones that I've seen, I just call watchers. And some of them have unbelievably beautiful faces, and they've got these really amazing eyes. And coming out of the eyes is this sort of beam of light that looks very much to what we would understand as laser. And they, for somehow, some way, can project information or energy down this beam. So what they're doing and why they're watching, I don't know yet. But it's all part of this transdimensional cake that we were talking about before when you mentioned it.
Yeah, and right back to that we go. You know, Stuart, a lot of people have had NDEs.
Yes.
Have claimed not only to see dead relatives, but to see creatures like Greys and like many other forms of creatures, as though this plane that we're talking about has not just human spirits in it, but all kinds of spirits in it.
Definitely.
I know we're grappling in the dark here, but is it possible that what we think of as life after death and the place we go is the place where some of these beings also go?
Definitely. I mean, it's definitely. There's a transdimensional reality out there. And perhaps after the top of the hour, Art, I could talk to the listeners about how to have a near-death experience without having to have a road accident and go to surgery.
Huh.
Because there's a way of actually doing it naturally. It takes time. I mean, it took me many years. But if you can entrance yourself and simulate death and stay awake, you can actually see the near-death tube.
Are you aware, Stuart, there are people out there experimenting with drugs, which I will not name, that actually induce near-death?
Well,
did you know about that?
Yes. I don't know which sort of transcendental drugs you're talking about, but there certainly are. There are certain drugs that...
They're dangerous.
Yeah, I would think they're extremely dangerous. But
yes.
You can do it naturally. And if you can teach yourself to entrance yourself and not fall asleep, and we all entrance ourselves every night.
Well, are you really talking now about simulation of an NDE, or are you talking about an OBE?
No,
or are
I'm talking
they...
about an NDE now, a near-death experience. But you're in trance, your body's catatonic, you cannot feel it, but you can actually see the near-death tube. And when I started to see that near-death tube, I discovered that at the bottom of the tube, there's a singularity. And just to explain that, a singularity is an area of extreme gravity. So, like, for example, Hawkins would talk about the singularity inside a black hole, you know?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Okay. When I got, let's say, within 20 yards in my mind's eye from the bottom of the tube,
yes.
I couldn't move any further. And it took me 3 years to cover the last 20 yards. But in the end, I found I could lay at the bottom of the near-death tube in my mind's eye and actually pull those transdimensional worlds to me. The tube has a bend in it. I don't know what effect, gravitational or spiritual or whatever.
Just one thing, Stuart.
Yep.
You know, an awful lot of people die in their sleep.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
How do you know that they didn't just go a little too far toward the light? Hold on, Stuart. We'll be back. We'll talk about how to induce an NDE after the break.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from October 27th, 1999.
there's no beginning, there'll be no end. 'Cause on my love, you can depend. I see your face before me as I lay on my bed.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from October 27th, 1999.
I'm getting flooded with all of it. This is typical. Just came in. Art, I'm an audio engineer in southeast Wisconsin near Milwaukee. I've never been a real believer nor non-believer in the presence of UFOs. Last night I was returning home at 12:30 a.m., pulled into my driveway, where I proceeded to get out of my van, noticed how bright the almost full moon was. That's right, almost full moon. Crystal clear, so bright you could see without any lights. Well, as I walked to my front door, the moon went out, for lack of a better term. No clouds. I was surprised, looked up, and saw a black triangular shape completely blocking out the moon as it moved in an east-northeast direction. I could see the moon's glow highlight the object. It took almost 5 minutes to disappear in the blackness and stars above. It's everywhere you go, all right. Somebody is asking here what time we're going to arrive in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, business aviation there. I don't know. I suppose if we leave here at 9:30, say, or 9:45, then you would have to commute how long it would take to get to Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I don't have the slightest idea. Somebody else wants call letters. I am W6OBB. I will be, obviously, aeronautical mobile. So you can listen for any of us. We'll all be aeronautical mobile. And no, we're not going to let Bob push little buttons. Bob wants to push buttons on airplane. Somebody said, put a mitt on the guy, you know? That's what we'll do. Last words, what does that little red button do? All right, it's back to Stuart Wild now. Stuart, NDEs. I've had people on here without giving the name, as I told you, actually saying that you can induce them with drugs. Very dangerous. You have another way to do it. How?
Well, what you do is you use a theta metronome, which is a series of clicks that run at 4 cycles a second. That's the theta brainwave rhythm that is natural to the human body, and we drop through these various brain rhythms during our natural sleep at night. By listening to a metronome, you train your body to get down to a very, very low brain speed without falling asleep. And what happens normally is when we get down to about there, we fall asleep at night.
Right.
But you can stay awake. And say, for example, you can get a theta metronome any place, but like I have one on a series called The Art of Meditation, which won Product of the Year a couple of years ago. And then I also have a delta metronome, which is running like even slower.
You are familiar with the work of Mr. Monroe, the late
yes,
Robert.
Yes, I knew
Robert,
and I hung out with him a little bit before he died, and that's what he uses. And
precisely.
Then he has this hemi-sync thing where
yes.
he balances both sides of the brain and so on.
Yes.
But by listening to a metronome, you can get your brain speed down very, very low. And I learned that. I did an out-of-body thing with Robert Monroe maybe 20 years ago, maybe, and went on from that. And once you can do it, what happens is eventually you will see the near-death tube without being in trauma surgery because you will simulate death, but you're not actually dead. You're just lying in emotionless state. Do you follow me?
I do, but isn't that kind of tickling the tail of the tiger?
No, you're completely awake. I mean, it's the same thing as we do every night of our life.
I know, but I repeat. Now, you think about this carefully. A lot of people die in their sleep.
Yes.
And how do you know these, some of them at least, are not people who simply, you know, went too far?
Well, that's very possible, but then if you wound up in the arms of God, it wouldn't be a bad night, you know? It'd sure be better than waking up in the arms of your mortgage. the kids than having to feed the dog. So that was probably part of the evolution.
I never thought of it that way, but I suppose.
You know, I mean, who knows? Yeah, it's possible. But I don't think you can kill yourself by going into a trance, you know? Because it's a natural brain state, except it happens at night, so you're not aware of it, you know?
And so you can get that close. You eventually can actually make it to the opening, to the light?
Yes. Well, there's a tube. And then what happened to me was that when I finally got past the singularity,
yes,
which is this area of extreme gravity at the bottom of the tube, I started trying to look up it. And one of the problems with that is that those other dimensions are facing us, so they're like mirrored. They're opposite us. And as I try to push my feelings or the force of my will up the tube, nothing happened. And I went through the most frustrating 9 months of my life. Then one day I got the idea to try to suck what was at the other end of the tube towards me.
Toward you.
Yeah. Then it worked. And it worked instantly. And I saw gray worlds. I saw hellish worlds. I saw miserable worlds. I saw celestial worlds.
Oh.
But you got to suck. You got to pull it, not push. But that's a bit how it is in life. If you're going for something in life and you push very emotionally for it, it hops up the road in front of you.
Well, Stuart, there are some things that have impressed me incredibly on my own program. A young lady named Sarah described a near-death experience. And I've been puzzling over this ever since. And she was a church volunteer. You know, this was when she was very young. And she was in doing church volunteer work. She left the church. She was on her way home on her bicycle. And she was hit by one of those big 18-wheelers and thrown, God, I forget, 150 feet. She was clinically dead. And she said she went through a series of worlds, a series of doorways through worlds. And some of them were hellish. Some of them seemed to be people in, you know, millions of heads in agony, that kind of thing. And then she encountered a light being as well. But she went through this hellish thing first. And I thought it puzzling for such an angelic person to have to do. But it was a remarkable description. I'm not doing it justice. But it parallels kind of what you were just saying.
Well, I think we are exposed to the panorama of possibilities. So she would have looked at those hellish worlds and kind of skipped past them quick and probably felt most comfortable with the angelic celestial being.
She did.
And I think after that story, Art, if I remember rightly, you played that tape of that hellish world that's at the bottom of the Siberian
hole. You
really
do listen a lot, don't you?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Yeah. You have a huge following in Europe, you know, because I know friends and readers of mine that email me from Italy, Germany, Denmark, Hungary, France, I mean, all over Western Europe, you know. So I don't know if you follow who hits you.
No, I do. I get the emails. I know. It's amazing.
There's loads of them. Well, then you played, after that story of her, you played the sound of this hellish dimension
that's right.
The geologists in Siberia discovered when they put a microphone down a hole, right?
That's right. That's correct, yes.
And that was truly amazing.
And well, I'm glad you heard it. Then you know what I mean. That was a really profound NDE explanation. Really,
yeah,
profound.
Really profound. And what's interesting about the sound that you played, which was so demonic and so hellish, it is actually the sound, I believe, of ordinary people's thoughts. Not everybody's thoughts, but, you know, like if you took a cross-section of a city street, they are going through that kind of anguish and pain. They believe their thoughts to be silent. Mm-hmm. But if you could actually record their thoughts, it would be similar. And that's the sort of the pain, the cruelty, the injustice, the nastiness of life compared to the love, the kindness, the spirituality, the openness of life.
I want to read to you something that it is said that you wrote, and I want to know what you mean by this, all right? It is said you wrote, "Right now the earth is circled by a very powerful band of darkness. There is a very superior force sustaining that for its own reasons. At ground level, the world ego is dying. Its vision has been fatally injured. The world will get worse very quickly once the markets melt." And it goes on. Are those your words?
Yes, so they are. Yeah.
And what did you mean by all that?
Well, what I meant was that I believe that there is a transdimensional band of energy around our Earth. That's negative. And then beyond that, there's another band that's celestial. I believe that the influence of the dark energy has permeated our government, the secret government, a lot of the infrastructure of our world, and that's why our world is becoming more and more controlling. There's more techno-fascism. There's more violence against ordinary people. Do you follow me? By the government.
Of course.
And that is so unnecessary because most people are very law-abiding. You know, I was at Albuquerque Airport today, and they dusted down my computer, and they wouldn't leave for half an hour. You know, and finally they said to me, oh, do you take heart tablets? And I said, yeah, you know, I've got this really dodgy heart, you know, because I wanted to get away. So if I said yes, they'd let me go, you know. But, I mean, like, I'm a law-abiding citizen.
Well, you know why they do that, don't you? They dust your computer to find out if there's any trace of explosives in your computer.
Oh, right. Well, anyway, I just didn't know what it was. But, I mean, here I am.
Well, that's what it was. So now
I'm a law-abiding citizen. I don't have any bombs in my computer. And I
they must have found something.
Yeah, you know, it could be anything. Like, I had incense in there.
Oh, incense?
You're like Indian incense, you know, because sometimes I light that and I meditate and pray. And
that might have been it.
And it could have been it. But it's like, hey, I think to myself, my goodness me, here am I, I'm just an ordinary Joe, you know, going out of Albuquerque, and I'm there for half an hour with these people while they're dusting my computer, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that band of energy that I was talking about is this sort of nastiness, this fascist influence that is permeating the world. But beyond that is the celestial influence. But, you know, perhaps we have to go through a bit of darkness and go through this whole millennium changeover before we create a world of goodness and kindness and love and
spirituality. How close to the rougher period do you think we are?
Not more than a couple of years, I'd say, top whack.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we're really going through some strange times. I think between now and the spring of 2000, I think it's going to be pretty wild riding.
Oh, it's weird. Now, I mean, you know, you were talking about the triangles, the flying triangles, and we have a phenomenon in Great Britain, which I'm sure, you know, Lindemann and those kind of guys that get on your show talk about. But they fly down from a place in Scotland called Donnybrook, and they kind of come down the west coast, and this enormous triangle came down the west coast maybe 6 months ago, and was seen by hundreds of people, including, I think, half a dozen policemen in Cornwall.
Right.
But then the next morning in the papers, they said, oh, meteor shower.
Yeah, I know.
You know, amazes everybody. And here's this enormous triangle hovering over a bunch of policemen who are trained at observing, making notes, being accurate. And the papers have this audacity to pretend like it's a meteor. It's ridiculous.
Oh, I know. The latest explanation here is returning rocket boosters from Russia.
Yeah.
Re-entering rocket boosters.
Yeah.
We're getting a lot of that. But, I mean, it's really becoming overwhelming. And when you have commercial airline pilot crews, two at a time, reporting exactly the same thing, it seems to me it's going to get more and more difficult for the Air Force or whoever tries to explain these things to explain. Did you see the Roswell thing? You know when they tried to explain Roswell?
Yes.
With that
little silver foil and that kind of stuff. And
the poor colonel sent out there to try and explain this?
Yeah, I mean, that's madness. And of course, the papers and the media, generally speaking, you know, TV and so on, they do it a great disservice because they either report it as like, these guys must be slightly nuts, ha-ha, tee-hee, or they just flat-out lie, you know?
Yeah, but you know what? I think that's beginning to get a little thin, and I think we're getting very close to some sort of massive change in this area because it's getting way too obvious.
Yes, yes.
Way too obvious. That must mean that, you know, when I say something's coming, I'm not even sure what it is, but it must be getting closer with the number of sightings we're having. I mean, I've never in my years seen anything like we're having right now.
No, I mean, it's hundreds of thousands. I mean, it's probably millions per annum. And I was at a fire in Ireland. It was like late at night. Yeah. And there was a group of seminar participants, and I was taking them on a journey through Ireland. And we were just, we had this bonfire out at night, and we were kind of just meditating, and we were in trance, and then we were talking, and we were hanging out. And this UFO came over us, like very, very high up. I mean, many, you know, maybe 100,000 feet up or whatever. And it was doing all these sort of gyroscopic, acrobatic moves in the sky. And it hovered over us for like 40 minutes.
Wow.
So much so that, like, we gave up watching it because, like, you know, you can't look up forever before you get a pain in the neck. And it's, like, sort of so amazing that, like, here's a group of people that are doing some stuff that's really conscious and it's really, let's say, out there because it's, like, meditative or it's very trancey. And, hey, they're watching. They're watching. And they're watching ordinary people, and they're watching anybody that's doing anything strange, and they're right there. I mean, there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of sightings now, you know?
Well, it probably means that whatever's going on, I worry a lot about Earth, and maybe they worry a lot about Earth. In other words, maybe what occurs in our dimension may in some way affect theirs. And they may be looking at us right now, and they may be saying, boy, these people are really screwing it up. I mean, look at the ozone, look at the ice packs melting, look at the diseases among the fish and the crabs and the... I could go on and on and on about the environmental troubles we're having right now, and maybe they're looking at us and saying, look at that lower dimensional infestation. Look what they're doing to us.
Yeah, I mean, we've maybe looked real cruddy, you know. I mean, it's sad, and then somehow we have to just become more and more aware, you know.
There is that. I mean, there are two things going on, as you pointed out early on. But I'm afraid that the consciousness-raising part is still minuscule compared to the concrete laying apart.
Yeah, I mean, we've never had a voice, but now we do have a voice, and people like yourself are instrumental in allowing that voice to happen. So it's coming. And the power of people's feelings is enormous. It's like, for example, GM foods, you know, genetically modified foods.
Yes.
Well, in England, the Prime Minister was for it, the government were for it, and then the alternative people got up against it because, you know, there were reports about the fact of how it affected the immune system of rats and so on.
Right.
And the guy that brought out that report was a professor, and he got fired from the university and so on. Well, after about 9 months of pushing, and people would go out to these fields, and they would just symbolically destroy a little bit of the field. But, I mean, all of a sudden, the British government turned right around and said, wow, we need more research. And they changed from being totally pro-GM foods, hey, this is going to be the way to feed the world, to where now they're saying, hey, we aren't even going to do the tests anymore. So the power is with the people, but everybody has to get a little bit active and push.
All right. Stay right where you are. We'll be right back. Stuart Wilde is my guest. Stay right there. We're going to keep playing this right on up through the millennium to remind you of the last part of this last thousand years. Music is a big part of that, you know. It allows time travel.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from October 27, 1999. Presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired October 27th, 1999.
By the way, I am not going to the Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island unarmed. I will have with me a 35 millimeter camera. I'll have a Sony camcorder. And I'll have a digital camera. And I'll have my computer. And so, as a result, I should be able to send photographs back. So while I'm there, if you check the internet, you check my website, you'll probably see some pretty cool photos of the island and the hotel and all kinds of things. I don't know what's going to be there, but we'll take pictures and we'll send them back to you if possible. And how is that possible? The internet, of course. Once again, here is Stuart Wilde. Stuart, welcome back.
Thank you.
I think that many people, certainly in my audience at least, accept the fact that they are here, from wherever they are here. Now, we hear about abductions, some I believe, some I don't, kind of like crop circles. But something is obviously going on, and so the larger question then becomes, what do they want with us?
Well, I think Jacobs is right when he says that it's a DNA, you know, genetic harvesting thing. Because if they wanted the real estate, they could come and get it, you know?
Yeah.
Because they can move quicker than any of our planes, and they can do what they want. If they wanted the people, let's say they wanted to kill everybody off, well, they could probably do that as well. So they don't want the people, and they don't want the real estate, and they sure as hell don't want the money. So what else do they want? Well, maybe they want the genetic material or the genetic memory that we have.
Well, the only thing I'm not sure about is the real estate. Now, they may have one timetable and we may have another.
Yeah,
they may see that if they just hang loose and wait for a while, they'll have the real estate.
Well, that's probably correct because, I mean, they may be generating, you know, some kind of like creeping takeover or whatever it might be. And then again, there's this mystery of like how did we all appear because, as you've mentioned before, you know, Cro-Magnon man just appeared mysteriously 30,000 years ago. And, you know, we are not genetically linked to the Neanderthals.
Yes, what do you think then? I think I know what you think, but I'll make you say it. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I cannot state categorically that I know how Cro-Magnon man appeared, but it would seem that if there was a little bit of a genetic interference and you got 5 or 10,000... you know, men and women going 30,000 years ago, eventually the Cro-Magnon man was faster and brighter than the Neanderthals, and the Neanderthals died out and Cro-Magnon man appeared, you know? But it is a mystery that's never been explained archaeologically as to how suddenly 30,000 years ago we all appeared here.
Yes, that's quite correct. Do you lean toward you recall 2001 and the obelisk? In other words, was there intervention?
Well, you know, nobody can say for certain that there was or there wasn't, but certainly now that we have the technology to understand how that might have happened, it makes it a greater possibility.
Well, it bothers me a lot that we live in a time where, you know, 30-plus years ago we went to the moon and back, haven't been out since, and we haven't even figured out what the pyramids are all about, what these odd stone structures worldwide and pyramids worldwide are all about. There was an apparent technology long ago that we haven't even figured out yet here on Earth.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mystery. I've been in the Great Pyramid, and I've been underneath it below the Queen's Chamber, and I've been there on my own. And what was amazing about being inside the King's Chamber was that all the electronic equipment that I took in there, which were basically, you know, brain machines to monitor brain waves and stuff, nothing would work inside the King's Chamber.
Really?
Just flat out wouldn't work. Then we go back down to the Mena House Hotel, which is at the bottom of the pyramid. Everything would be working fine. Then we go back to the pyramid at 6 in the morning.
Uh-huh.
This is before it was open for tourists. And we'd go through all these experiments, and nothing would work again. And we did that for 3 days in a row, and we just quit on trying to work with the machinery.
Uh-huh.
So there's a force in there, definitely, without any shadow of a doubt.
Well, I was there, and I had a tour. I went to the same place as you did, pretty much. But I was with Dr. Hawass, Zahi Hawass.
Yes.
And he has a really hardcore view And he says the Egyptians built the pyramids, and there's quite a bit of evidence to indicate they did. But the place where Zahi stops is when you ask him, well, Zahi, how did they do it? And he goes, ah, but Art, that is the mystery, isn't it?
Yes.
So he doesn't have the slightest idea, nor does anybody else.
Yes, and also he controls the whole of the plateau. So he's the one that says, hey, we'll send a robot up the tunnel at the top of the Queen's Chamber, or we won't.
Right. Yeah,
you know,
right.
We'll dig up underneath the pool of the pyramid, or we won't. So,
do you trust him?
Well, I can't say that he's a dishonest man, Art, because I've never met him, you know?
Uh-huh.
And then again, he and the Egyptian government may have an agenda of slow and gradual release of information, because obviously they are custodians of enormous heritage of art
That's
and knowledge.
Correct.
And,
you're correct. No, no, listen.
They
may
not want a whole bunch of people just tunneling through their stuff,
right.
You know?
That's right. No, listen, he's a friend of mine. We're actually friends with each other.
Yeah.
But he knows I don't trust him.
Yeah.
And he knows that I think that if he had a major paradigm-shifting kind of find, that we would not know about it.
Yeah.
And we might not know about it for a long time.
Well, that's a fact, and that's what I was saying. They have an agenda, and we don't know what their agenda is, but it's their property, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like if somebody wanted to tunnel under the White House, we might say, wait a minute, we're not going to let you do that.
But I mean, thousands of years ago, something was going on that we can't duplicate or figure out today.
No. There's no way of working out how those stones got lifted.
None at all.
And, you know, and be slotted into, like, you know, 1/64th of an inch, you know, weighing 32 tons.
Right, that's right. There's no way. There's just simply no way for science to explain it, which means that there was some sort of technology, some sort of technology that may not, I mean, I use the word technology very loosely. It may not have been machines at all that did this.
Well, one thing that's very interesting is, you know, when you mentioned earlier on in the show, Kaku's hyperspace.
Yes.
Okay. If you put two pyramids base to base, they form an octahedron.
Right.
And if you reverse them in and out of each other, so the bottom pyramid floats up to the top pyramid and the top pyramid floats down to the bottom pyramid.
Yes.
You wind up with this sort of mirror reality that's moving back and forth. Now, one day I had a vision, and I saw an acrobat jumping around a wall, and I realized, wow, that's a square with two diagonals across it. Then if you pick up the diagonals from the center of the square, it makes a pyramid. Then if you stick another pyramid on top of the top pyramid, you have this octahedron. Then I had a vision of the coordinates, and the coordinates actually are like west 33, east 173, 80 north, and 60 south. And if you just subtract them from each other, they're completely mirrored. Then when you calculate the two pyramids moving inside each other, converting and inverting, mm-hmm. they come to 2,704. The square root of 2,704 is 52. Because there's two pyramids, you have to divide them by two, and you get back to 26 dimensions. So it could be that the pyramid is actually a description of half of our reality.
Yeah, it may well be it explains a lot of things they knew that we don't. And
definitely.
And so... I guess I've got to ask you, you went in with scientific instruments, obviously you did a great deal of study. What did you conclude anything, or give me your best guess about
the... No, what I concluded was that there was something in there that was not going to allow us to discover what was going on. Do you follow me?
Oh, yes.
So it's like going somewhere, you trip an infrared beam, and suddenly none of your computers will work, you know? So we were frustrated in our attempts to try to discover what was happening there. But, again, there's a power there. You know, and it's the same with the UFOs. You know, if the UFOs were benign, we'd know about it. The fact that it's all secret and hidden away, you've got to question why, you know? Why is the government, say, spending so much money on misinformation, disinformation, you know, confusion, if it's up and above board? Do you follow me?
Yes. Well, the government does not... The full government, our elected government, they're a bunch of blabbermouths. They can't keep secrets. And so we've got to imagine, I think, that if some offshoot basement operation part of the government knows about this, not all of the government knows about this because they couldn't possibly keep it secret.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's people that spend a lot of money, you know, making sure that people are, like, generally confused most of the time.
Yes, I've met some of those people, actually, at a distance and close up. There's a lot of disinformation going on right now, and attempts to discredit people.
Yes.
When they cannot do it directly in substance, then they do it with attacks on character. That's going on all over.
Yeah, that's going on all over. And in fact, anybody who sticks their head up above the parapet opens themselves up to...
Or as the Chinese say, the nail that sticks up is the one that gets hammered down.
Exactly, exactly.
And I've been hammered on a few times, and I'm sure you have too.
Yeah, well, I mean, I try to keep my head low, but, I mean, it's the same for everybody. Like, for example, guys like David Icke, you know, they come up against all sorts of trouble all the time.
Oh,
right?
I bet they do. Mm-hmm. What do you... I want to sneak a question in on you here. I did a show the other night on secret societies.
Yes.
And while some of it was humor and silly, some of it was not. And there are societies out there that may hold information, the kind of information we were talking about that we imagine might come from Giza one day, for example,
mm-hmm.
that's been passed from generation to generation to generation. Do you believe that?
Yes, sir, I do. Definitely. I mean, there are people that know, and there are other people that have discovered. They may not necessarily be part of any society, but they figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, there are people that are immensely wise, and they hold it among themselves, and they again have an agenda, hopefully a benign one.
Well, I have, for example, Richard Hoagland on from time to time, and he talks of this kind of thing, and many times people scoff when he does, but the fact of the matter is, these secret organizations and societies really do exist, and they really do hold secrets, and they really do pass them down, and there really is something to it, and I'm not sure where to go to crack that egg and whether I should even try. Probably not.
Well, if the knowledge is real, they're not going to tell you. That stands to reason. But then there's a lot of people that have the knowledge, but they just can't pass it on because they would get into too much trouble,
mm-hmm.
or it would become so prolific that it may be misused.
Mm-hmm.
So like, for example, I'm in touch with certain people in Europe, and I don't mean to make this sound mysterious, but these are people that are experts in inner worlds and dimensions and so on. And I can go visit with them and hang out, and we can go look at things, or we can talk about things. But it isn't something that they can write a book on or say, oh, and by the way, next week in France, we're going to all get together in a hotel and discuss it. Do you follow me?
Yes.
Because it draws too much attention, it puts them in danger, and it's awfully difficult to explain a lot of stuff, you know, and therefore it makes them look strange and kooky, so they just live in their own world.
Have you been told anything, Stuart, by any government official of any of the governments of the countries you frequent?
No, sir.
That you cannot talk about?
No, I have not. And I'm not actually in touch with those people because I tend to keep well away. Partly because, Art, all the time that I've been working, I've been discovering on my own, you know? And I've discovered a certain amount, and so I'm a researcher into the etheric, into transdimensional states, and I don't want to have anything to do with any of the governments. So if anybody knocked on my door, I'd just play dumb, you know?
Mm-hmm. But I mean, government does mix in these things. I talked to Ingo Swan earlier today, and he's going to come on the air with me after the 15th sometime, and he's a father of remote viewing, and.
Yep.
You know, all of that also seems to mix, to me, it mixes in the same plane, if not the same way, but in the same etheric plane.
Yeah.
How else can a mind reach across the world and find a gas canister in Iraq or something and draw it and tell them where it is?
Well, I mean, he was hired by the government, wasn't he, and worked for them for a while.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah, so he would be more connected.
Well, he's considered to be the I call him the great-grandfather of, and he laughed, of remote viewing, but he is.
Yeah.
And if remote viewing is real, and they spent $20 million in 20 years on it, then I think they're still doing it. Now, every one of them denies it, but if it's real, how could they not be doing it?
Now, I'm sure they are doing it. I'm sure also they have the ability to sort of, you know, we said at the beginning of the show that it's only the slowness of the velocity of the physical plane as we understand it
that makes it solid.
Right.
And they may have all sorts of equipment that can make things slightly unsolid. So they're already beginning to, like, be able to look through walls and so on. So they're already moving into that trans-dimensional place, you know? So a surveillance unit can fire a beam in your house and figure out which room you're in, you know?
That's right.
And they can figure out whether you have a painting on the bedroom wall or not.
Oh, Stuart, they can hear you and they can see you. They can see your heated little body moving about from room to room.
And so they're already in this trans-dimensional world. Now, metaphysicians are people like myself. You know, I go there naturally for benign reasons. And I'm trying to get people to see this infinity inside of themselves. And I wrote a book once, which became sort of a classic called Infinite Self. And that Infinite Self book has transformed a lot of people because it showed them how to get in touch with the power themselves. But our governments have that much money and that much clout at their disposal that they're already crossing into that trans-dimensional world, you know?
Actually, you've written 20 books. And I suppose if I ask you your favorite, you'll say the one you just wrote.
No, my best book, the one that everybody says is a classic, is called Infinite Self.
So is that your personal favorite?
Yeah, it is in a way, because it really talks about how to activate the power inside of you, how to activate the etheric body, and how to draw from nature, from the force inside of you, to sort of enliven yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when people say to me, like if I stop at an airport, and they say, well, which books do it? Because of the 20 books I've written, 15 are out. I would say, oh, go buy Infinite Self. And they can get that from Amazon.com, or they can get it from HayHouse.com, HayHouse.com.
Yeah, we've got links up to just about all your books.
Yeah, but the Infinite Self is the one that really transforms people, because it doesn't go against their religious belief, but it awakens them to the power that's in their subtle body, that is in their perceptions. And it begins to take them into this trans-dimensional world. Okay, it's the first step. But it's like the sort of the little ABC Bible of how to wake yourself up to the power that is really inside of you.
That's great. All right. We're going to break here at the top of the hour. When we come back, I would like to begin to open the phone lines for you.
Wow.
Would you like to talk to everybody out there?
I'd love to. I'd absolutely love to. Thank you.
All right. Well, that's what's coming up next. Stand by. This is not a telephone commercial, but it is a big memory from this millennium, isn't it? I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from October 27th, 1999. Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from October 27, 1999.
Now listen here, we're about to go to open lines with Stuart Wilde, and obviously with as much as he has given us already, you should have questions. So those are the numbers, and
We welcome your presence, Stuart Wilde, and perhaps you, in a moment. Listen to this. This is from the BBC, and it just arrived. It's an article entitled, Neanderthals Survived Longer Than Thought. Typical scientific retraction. Neanderthals, it says, once portrayed as grunting primitive cavemen, lived as recently as 28,000 years ago, according to research on bones found in a cave in Croatia. They probably also, get this, interbred with modern humans, said the scientists. Previous evidence suggested that Neanderthals died out some 34,000 years ago and were replaced by modern Homo sapiens. But the international team did more testing on the Neanderthal bones found in the 1970s, found they were a lot younger than that. Quote, the new radiocarbon dates suggest that Neanderthals would have, get this, folks, coexisted with early modern humans in Central Europe for several millennia, end quote. That's from Fred Smith of the Anthropology Department at Northern Illinois University. Now, you know, this simply suggests to me that we don't really know what the hell the story is. And we look back these thousands of years, and we're constantly correcting ourselves. We don't really know, do we, Stuart?
No, I mean, definitely not. I think, you know, most people are convinced that Neanderthals and modern man live side by side. But how and when they died out, the Neanderthals, nobody knows. I think it's really interesting that they were so recent, you know?
It really is very interesting, yes, yes. All right, well, I promised we would go to the phones, and so here we go. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Stuart Wilde. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing tonight, Art?
Just fine.
Great. Stuart, it's Ross. How are you, mate?
I'm right. I'm well.
That's good to know. Listen, I got a question for you. Been listening to Greenwood, and I absolutely love it. It's a beautiful album. And I wanted to find out how you came up with the inspiration for the lyrics on it.
Well, it's a little bit off tonight's topic, but just to answer you very, very quickly, it's the story of the forces of light and dark, and there's a myth, a fairy myth in Ireland, that the forces of light, the shining ones, had a war, a battle with the forces of dark called the Fomorians. So the concept was not my concept, it's part of Irish mythology. But I just wrote the story in the songs of that particular album, Voice of the Celtic Myth, which actually won New Age Album of the Year last year. But
did it really? Was,
really?
Yeah, it
oh,
did,
that's
yeah.
fabulous.
But
yeah.
It's the story of the forces of lightness and dark and the battles between what were known as the Shining Ones or the Fairy Gods and the dark forces called the Fomorians. And I can see that going on today. There's a battle between spirit and ego, you know, between softness, love,
right,
and then control and hatred. So that's what inspired me to do it.
Oh, well, it's an absolutely beautiful CD, and the music is wonderful, and the lyrics are great.
Thanks.
And looking forward to seeing you in L.A.
All right, man. God bless you, man.
All right. By the way, you are here on a U.S. tour, right?
Yeah, I'm doing San Francisco tomorrow night, and then...
So you're actually toward the end of it now?
Yeah, and then San Diego the night after that, and L.A. The night after that.
Well, break it down a little bit. Where are you going to be in the Bay Area?
At the Crown Plaza Hotel tomorrow night at 6 o'clock.
Ooh, all right. And then?
And then down in San Diego. I don't know the address, but people can check it out at powersource.com/wild, W-I-L-D-E.
Okay. All right. But at least you know where you're going to be in San Francisco. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Wild.
Hello. Thank you very much for your radio show.
You bet. Thank you.
Okay. And my question is concerning the Carlos Castaneda teachings. They teach there's 600 different worlds once you pull out of this world. Now, earlier, before, you were talking about a scientist that said maybe there's 26 different realms.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, why just 26 and not, say, 600 like the Castaneda teachings
All right.
talk about?
All right.
I don't know what your answer is, Art, but, you know, I'm not saying there are only 26 dimensions. All I said was that Kaku talks about a hyperspace of 26 dimensions.
Well, once we imagine the dimensions beyond which we can move, then we can imagine, if we can imagine one, we can imagine 26 or 600, I suppose.
Yes, sir, definitely. I mean, we're not big enough to figure it out, and I don't know how Castaneda said there was 600. I'm not saying he's wrong, or that he was wrong, but, I mean, maybe that's as far as his perception went, and there's actually 612 or whatever. Who knows, you know?
Somebody writes and asks you to explain your statement that it is military strength, political power, financial clout, both corporate and private. Please ask Mr. Wilde comment on these issues in reference to the IMF's current leading accounting methods and relief of the Asian crisis, and some people think the engineered market to not crash exactly, sort of. It's been a pretty bad market lately. Do you have comments on the world financial situation?
I sometimes talk about it, Art, in my books and articles and so on, because it's part of the sort of overall metaphysical story of what's going on. The Asian crisis was definitely an engineered crisis. Okay, those Asian countries perhaps bought it on themselves because they were tickled along to spend too much money and to hawk themselves and perhaps grow too quickly. But, you know, there was and there is always a concerted, organized plug-pulling day when everybody agrees to pull the plug simultaneously and bang, down they come, you know? There's the same kind of manipulation going on in the gold markets, and some of the gold experts that you've had on your shows and so on have talked about that. You know, some of these markets, they look like they're free markets, but there's enormous organizations that run the markets.
Well, I'm afraid I believe that. And there are a lot of little people that get manipulated and hurt when they do that.
Yep.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Stuart Wilde and Art Bell. Good morning.
Yeah, hi, Stuart. I wanted to ask you what you think you may see for the future or the near future.
Well, I talk a lot about the death of the ego, and that's the death of this arrogant vision that says that we can expand and consume and pollute and control the planet. The planet has a mind. It has a feeling. You know, if you're familiar with the work of Lovelock, you know, it's Gaia. It has a feeling. It isn't going to allow us to carry on the way we're going. So at some point, I've got a feeling that the world will have to retract from this sort of massive hedonistic, forward-surging consumption, and to come back to a more placid, you know, more organic, more natural way of living. So I've got a feeling a correction's coming.
I'll agree with you on that. If I may just ask one more quick question. You know, I've read a lot of different things, and about this ancient technology, do you see us discovering that, or do you think maybe, like, the Egyptian government will finally let us do something with discovering the pyramids and the pyramid technology? Art spoke about, like, the black box and all this kind of funny stuff. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, I think so. I mean, Art and I were talking earlier on. You know, there's this trans-dimensional perception that is becoming more and more normal. And writers like myself that talk about it and that explain techniques are bringing people along to that place. I've got a feeling that the ancient knowledge isn't that far away from us, but perhaps we need more experimentation, a longer time to appraise what we already know. And then, of course, the organizations that, you know, Art's in touch with that specialize in this trans-dimensional power source knowledge and so forth. And this secret knowledge is being uncovered. It isn't that secret anymore.
Do you think there's any way that we can, like, maybe force the Egyptian government to, you know, I mean, is there,
no,
just want to say, if it wasn't for your show, people like us wouldn't be able to come out and ask these questions. And I want to thank you for the format. This is a great show.
Okay, sir. Thank you. Is there some way we can force the Egyptian government to cough these secrets up, I think you wanted to know.
Yeah, I mean, I would say dream on, you know? I mean, it's their real estate, it's their treasure, it's their heritage, and it's their religion, or it was, and they will uncover it when and if, and let it out when and if, and so forth.
Actually, that's exactly the way they feel.
Yeah.
And they say so, unabashedly. And I understand. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Stuart Wild. Hello?
Hello?
Hi there.
Hi. Stuart, your show is wonderful. I'm just so fascinated listening to you and listening to everybody calling in. My question is rather a personal one. I've been meditating quite a lot in the last, ever since I was maybe 5 or 6 years old. It's always come naturally to me. And as I got older, I took some classes and trance work and in, you know, deeper meditation techniques. And I had some extremely frightening experiences, mostly on my own, actually. And it would happen before I'd go to bed. And it would be, I would be half awake and half asleep, but totally aware of my consciousness. And I would get this intense, almost painful sound in my ears, almost like a jet propeller trying to take off from my head.
Right.
And I felt like it would be trying to take me somewhere.
Right.
And I feel just the sensation of trying to go higher and higher and higher, but the sound and the intensity got just so much, I'd have to come out of the trance.
That sure sounds like the beginning of an OBE.
Yes. I mean, that's exactly what it is, I'm sure of it, you know?
It's funny, I've had OBE experiences before that were different than that, but this was almost like painful. Like the sound was so loud, it was just unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, that's been described by a lot of researchers, the sound, and also the tugging sensations. I don't know, did you feel a tugging sensation at the top of your head?
Well, yeah, and in my ears. Mostly it's in my ears.
So either something's trying to tug you out of your body, or your body is trying to spontaneously come out. And that would be your etheric moving around the room while your body was, let's say, lying on the bed or wherever you're meditating.
Yeah, that's like a buzzing sound.
Yeah, let it buzz. Just go with it. And then if you're out there and you see anything really, really gruesome, because, you know, there's the whole interdimensional world, the closest interdimensional domains are sometimes very demonic or very gruesome, but they're only as powerful as you are scared. So if you're not scared of them, you know, like if you look something in the eye, like I've seen things that like look like 20-foot-high monsters of green fangs. And
yeah,
look,
I've had that experience, too.
Have you? Yeah.
And okay. I was so terrified and I was fascinated at the same time. It was like dragons with fire coming out of their mouths with, you know, three heads.
Well, he says, if you're not afraid, you can't be hurt, so...
You come. And the name of the game is to step forward and go bug off, you know? And they'll pop like a soap bomb, you know?
I have a question for you. You're in America now, where the Art Bell program thrives, and this kind of information flows, and the X-Files is a big hit, and all of this is going on, and we're having all of these sightings, and, you know, people are just sort of into all of this now because it's happening.
Yep.
But what about the more reserved British? Now,
it's not so open there because, you know, first of all, the talk shows there, there's fewer shows and there's less of it. But then again, the British have had this, like, thousand-year history of believing in the fairy kingdoms, the druids. They believe in UFOs. We've had our own sort of Roswell-type incidents there. And then there's this massive underground network in England in and around the crop circle. So the average person in England, they're not as aware as the Americans. And then the other people that are aware are very aware.
Mm-hmm. What do you think would happen if this program were aired in Britain?
Well, I think you'd have a massive following, you know. Because there's a starvation there, because there are very few major talk shows over there. And if they deal with this subject, they always deal with it in a very derogatory way.
Mm.
So they sort of say, look, we're going to interview this guy about psychic phenomena. He's really a nutcase, but hey, it's going to entertain you for half an hour, that kind of vibe.
Really?
Yeah, they don't really. They have to put it down because maybe they're instructed to or because they feel too uncomfortable. So they're not as open. But I have a feeling that... That you know, it's ready. In fact, I went to the biggest talk station in England and suggested that I did a late-night sort of UFO-type show. And they actually said, it'd be great ideas, Stu, you got the job. And then they said, well, who would you interview? And I said, well, I don't know, I just interview some of the experts. And they say, well, would you interview David Icke? And I said, yeah, of course. You know, and the guy started screaming up and down. He got really, really angry, the president of the radio show.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you would interview David Icke? And I said, yeah, because he's controversial and he's interesting and... Some people agree with him, some people don't, but that's the sort of people you want to interview. And I got fired, so I got the job for about 2 minutes.
That was it, huh?
That was it. The minute I mentioned I'd interview David, I got thrown out. Funny, huh?
Yes, I interviewed David Icke. They didn't toss me off. First time caller line, you're on the air with Stuart Wilde. Hi.
Oh, yeah, Art Bell.
That's me.
Good to talk to you. This is Nathan from Ottawa.
Yes, Nathan.
Illinois.
Yes, sir.
I was just kind of interested in the call, I mean, in the show tonight, and it was interesting that you had the Secret Society line on the other night.
Yes.
And I would just, Stuart might not be too happy with this, but I'd like to expose a little secret that you're probably talking to somebody who belongs to one of the most secret societies ever.
Really?
Yes.
What is it?
I believe he stems or from a sister society, or maybe from the society of the Theosophical Society, founded back in 1875 by a woman named Helen Blavatsky.
Stuart, are you a member of a secret society?
I'm not a member of a secret society. I'm my own society, and I'm not a member of the Theosophists, though I do respect that organization, and I have read the works of Blavatsky.
Well, that's kind of like saying you took a big long draw, but you didn't inhale. You respect them?
Well, I respect everybody, Art. You know, I sort of am famous for not making people wrong, you know, providing they're not hurting other people.
So you actually don't belong to it, then?
No, I do not belong to the Theosophists.
There you are.
The Theosophists.
Well, it was just sort of interesting, Stuart, that most of your, excuse me for a minute, sir, that most of your, the things that you talk about as far as your trans, those transcendental states of mind and... Hello?
Well, that doesn't mean he belongs to someone.
No, I'm just thinking that they use a few different types of words to kind of to show their association with the type of New Age type of thinking and the New Age type
well,
of...
Well, based on that, you could call kinds of my guests and say you belong to
them. Oh, sure. It's what's called a disintegrated, polycentric, integrated network. It's so intertwined with one another that nobody really knows who they are and how they're affiliated with the group.
But
you'll find that most of Stuart's, the things that Stuart says, if you read some of David Spangler's books or Alice Bailey's books or Helen Blavatsky's books, he's coming directly from what they taught in their books.
Do you agree with that, Stuart?
Yes, I was certainly influenced by many, many different writers, and also my books are very much laced with Taoist philosophy. And then all of my books have these very strange etheric techniques. Say, for example, the book like The Quickening is a good example. There are certain techniques in there that I teach, like turbo thought and so on, which Blavatsky never taught and didn't dream of teaching. So everybody that's written anything about consciousness would be aware of Rosicrucian writings, esoteric writings.
I've got you. Hold on. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from October 27th, 1999.
Dear, in every room, all I want to love you promise, beneath the haloed moon. But you think I should be happy?
There's no use in hanging around. Guess I'll get dressed and do the town. I'll find some crowded avenue, though it will be empty without you. Can't get used to losing you, no matter what I try to do. Gonna live my whole life through loving you. Call up some girl I used to know. After I heard her say hello, couldn't think of anything to say. Since you're gone, it happens every day. Can't get used to do. Gonna live my whole life through loving you. I'll find somebody, wait and see. Who am I kidding? Only me.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from October 27th, 1999.
Isn't it funny how you can fall in love with music all over again? Again and again. It's like you can keep falling in love. And this song does it for me. And I understand that's plucking of violins you're hearing. I don't know why it hasn't been used in more songs. It's really pretty. Stuart Wilde will be right back.
Now we take you back to the night of October 27th, 1999, on Art Bell's Somewhere in Time.
All right, Stuart, going down the home stretch. We are.
Right.
And a lot of people want to talk to you. So let us begin again. First time caller line, you're on the air with Stuart Wilde. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. This is Megan. I'm listening to you on WGY, outside of Albany, New York.
Indeed.
First of all, I'd like to say good morning, because it's almost daylight here.
That's right.
I'm very interested in your topic tonight, because I've had these kind of encounters with other entities my whole life, so... it's been an adventure, you could put it that way. I recently have started compiling these experiences into a manuscript, and I'm interested in what Stuart's advice might be in a couple areas. First of all, I find it very difficult to record these experiences. I've seldom talked with anyone about them. And there's so many that the confronting the accumulated volume of experience is pretty overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Formulate that into a question. In other words, how do you document them, or how do you collate them, or what?
What I'm doing is writing each experience down in as much detail as possible.
Right.
And I want to compile all of that, and there's been so many that it didn't start out to be a book, but it's sort of becoming one.
Okay. That's still not a question.
Okay. Well, the question is, I find it very difficult to write about this sort of thing, and much less, you know, just talking about it is difficult. And writing about it seems even more difficult.
Was it for you, Stuart?
I was a little bit hesitant at the beginning. But, you know, if you are a seeker, you have to be brave. So you're going to wind up in dimensions that are really scary. And you're going to wind up in strange experiences. I once tried to etherically turn myself inside out and completely fried myself. And I was sick for weeks. But it's our nature to explore. Write your experiences. Get a good editor. Make them very clear. And then send them to one of the esoteric publishers, and off you go. You know,
you
might have a bestseller on your hands.
Did you? Yeah, you might. Did you ever have things occur to you that you thought were so far out that if you wrote about them, you'd lose credibility?
Are you asking me, Art?
I am. Yes.
Yes, sir. Oh, yeah, lots. I mean, lots of things. And in fact, there are certain things that I have not put in my books yet because I don't know. You know, I don't know if it would blow it.
Like what?
Well, just. A lot of the inner nature of things, and say, for example, like the fairy kingdoms, okay? Now, most people think of little people with wings and the Victorian-style fairy kingdoms. But the true fairy kingdoms are these sort of alive flashes of energy where the trees and the rocks and the whole of the earth has a personality. Well, if you say, hey, I'm going to write a book about the fairy kingdoms, people look at you like you're so dippy-doo-lally. So I've stayed a little bit away from that kind of thing. Even though I have been in there and I could document it and talk to people about how to reach it and take a look at it.
Well, Native Americans wouldn't think it so crazy. I mean, they talk about the Earth as mother, as a living being all the time.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've got a great respect for their teaching, and...
I take it that wouldn't go down as easily in London.
Well, they're not so shamanistically oriented or Native American oriented, but then again, there's a lot of earth lore in England and in Ireland, all over Great Britain, in fact, the whole of Europe. So it's not that strange to people, but the actual reality of it is very strange. So let's say the etheric energy of a coyote is very strange to look at. And if you watch a coyote at night, you can see it's walking in this bubble, this glow. Then if you get into the etheric energy of the trees and the plants, you see how fast they're actually moving, that the tree is actually pulsing. And inside the tree, there's a fractal mathematics that is at the core of what the tree is. Okay, if you get into that stuff, you better be very scientific and very sensible. Otherwise, people think, hey, this guy's completely out to lunch.
Well, you know the experiments they've done with lettuce and that sort of thing, right?
Yep.
Vegetables? Pretty interesting scientific experiment showing they react.
Yep, definitely.
And they actually recognize people who have done things. I mean, that's pretty far out, but it's well documented.
Yeah, I mean, the nature is alive, and it's interacting with us, and we're interacting with it. You know,
that's
and we
right.
are the custodians of it, so it's a bit of a shame that we're kind of messing it up. But
yes, isn't it? Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Stuart Wild.
Is that me?
That's you.
Okay, this is Mike in Seattle.
Hi, Mike.
And looks like we're all writing books nowadays.
Oh?
Yeah, I've got books on the pyramids, the Manahunis, etc. So,
published or waiting to be?
Well, I've got them right here on my computer, but...
Okay, waiting to be then.
Yeah, right. So, what my question is on the pyramids, primarily. This one. I would like a follow-up also on the spirits, if it's all right. My father was a Mason and gave me what he thought were secrets of Masonry, and that was that the pyramids represent a lot of biblical correctness. For instance, there's 144,000 stones in the pyramids, and that these 144,000 stones represent the 144,000 lives that we go through, and that each stone compares to our DNA, and that it, as each life is sealed, the RAM, the memories of that life, then become ROM and become a part of you.
Hmm.
Once you have completed your pyramid, then you ascend to the celestial kingdom. Now, he further stated that each corner of the pyramid represents one of the four archangels, Jesus, Michael, Satan, and Lucifer. And on each side of each corner, of course, you have the two sides of everyone. You've got the Christ, the Antichrist, the Lucifer, the anti-Lucifer.
Okay, without going too much further, Stuart, does this sound like Masonic secret stuff to you?
Well, it is, yes, it's certainly familiar, and I think it is in some of the Masonic written material. I can't say that I'm a great expert on their teachings or their writings, but it certainly was linked mathematically and so forth back into history and into the biblical era, so... I don't know. I'm in an area here where I would not stand up as an expert.
Interestingly, there are a number of people who think that NASA has derived some information from the Giza Plateau and from Egypt and has acted on it. And
I would agree with that 100%.
Oh, you would, huh? All right. You had a follow-up question, sir?
Yes. With respect, first of all, to the pyramids, I understand that there are three of them around the world at 120-degree increments, and that they are directly placed over our grid lines.
Right.
And
we're kind of in a hurry here. We don't have a lot of time. So.
Okay, well, with respect to the grid lines and the Earth slowing, I was told that as the circumferential pressure on the grid lines relaxes due to our slowing, that the Earth is backing off the grid lines and causing the earthquakes. And you'll notice that the earthquakes are more severe at the equator than they are in the northern latitudes, which would say then, wow, is this whole Earth encompassed in a grid, as some people have stated?
All right. Stuart?
Well, it definitely is encompassed in a grid, and there's a whole grid of electromagnetic energy that flows back across the Earth, and that's a documented fact. So whether or not these three pyramids are on those grids or not, I can't say so, but yes, there's definitely a grid that runs, across our Earth. We know that there is, you know?
Well, we know it's pretty active. I'll tell you, we had a 7.0 earthquake here a few days ago, and it scared the hell out of me. I mean, this was one serious earthquake where I am here. And so I've been particularly conscious of them lately. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Stuart Wild. Hi.
Good morning, Art.
Morning.
Good morning, Stuart.
Morning.
I was intrigued by your description of a tunnel going through a tube to get to an NDE.
Yes.
All my life I've experienced a pattern, a visual pattern when I close my eyes. And in the center of that pattern is a hole.
Yes.
And just 2 years ago, I decided while I was meditating just to go into that hole.
Yes.
And I pulled out before I got too far in. It was very scary. It was rushing by.
That hole is right at the center of creation. And if you can stand the spookiness, go up to the hole and try to pull what's on the other side of the hole towards you. And if that doesn't work, just fly through it and grab hold of your private parts and hold your nose and go. And don't worry about how scared you get, because, you know, you could be right at the forefront of the knowledge we're looking for.
I have gone all the way through just once. It's one time I ended up...
What was on the other side?
It may sound weird, but it was a bar. I landed right in a bar room.
A bar room?
A bar room.
Like a pub?
Yeah.
Maybe that's to be our final reward for some, or hell.
There was someone there talking, and it's all faint to me now. I didn't bother taking notes or anything. I didn't believe it was real. I thought it was a dream.
Well, a pretty good one, I must say. You pop through, you make that wonderful spiritual trip, and you end up in a bar? West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Stuart Wild. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I've never seen a UFO or anything.
That's okay.
But when I was a kid, I did have the helicopters going around with the cattle mutilations and stuff like that.
Well, I don't think the helicopters are doing the cattle mutilations, but I think there's pretty good evidence that the helicopters are investigating cattle mutilations and right on the scene almost too soon.
Right. Well, that wasn't my question. But about 3 months ago, I had one of these, I don't know if it was an NDE or what, but I was asleep and probably for a little while, and then I just felt like I could see through my eyelids, and something was tugging on my shoulders, like pulling me out of my body, and I was so convinced there was somebody in the room with me that I just had to wake up.
Well, unless it was the image of death, I think you were about to have an OBE.
That's an OBE?
Yeah, out of body.
Yeah.
As opposed to near death.
Okay.
You can leave your body, and I am told by the experts.
So the next time, just go with it?
Yeah, go with it.
Another question I had was like the coincidences.
As Stuart said, grab your private parts and go.
Another question I had was like coincidences. Like you wrote the book Quickening. He wrote the book Quickening.
Yes.
It's like a lot of coincidences seem to be going on.
Oh, yes.
I don't know.
I think everybody's converging towards the same place. And
so do I.
You know, we're all light seekers, and we're all trying to discover, and, you know, we make mistakes, and we're misguided at times, and we're wrong at times, but we're all trying to head towards the light and head towards an explanation.
How's that?
I think it's a little bit more deeper than that for some reason. I don't know why. I can't explain it.
Well, that experience of yours, sir, right?
Excuse me?
Next time it happens, go with it, because something somewhere is trying to show you.
Yep.
But you have a transdimensional personality, you know, a being. You're more than you think you are. And that's really the nature of all of my writings, is to tell people, hey, okay, it's a bit spooky and scary maybe, but then sometimes sitting still on the same spot, you know, watching the ball game gets spooky and scary as well, because, hey, there's a light out there that's trying to get us to learn more about ourselves.
Right.
But going out that way sometimes is heck scary, but somebody has to go, so it might as well be you.
So in other words, go and then come back and talk to us.
Yep.
All right.
When it was happening, though, I felt like somebody was standing on my chest, and I couldn't breathe.
Right. That's a typical description, frankly. First time caller line, you're on the air with Stuart Wilde. Hi.
Hello, Art. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I've got a question for Stuart. It's kind of hard to describe. It's an event that happened to me three times in the past. It happens when I'm partly asleep, partly awake, somewhere in between, drifting kind of in semi-consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way to describe it is, let's say, like, if you had a baseball bat and you swung it through your body and it passed through your body, but it would actually impact your etheric or your soul.
Mm-hmm.
And give you one heck of a jolt, almost like your soul has sneezed or coughed, to the point it was very violent, scary, and at the same time, a very loud noise, and literally shook the roots of my foundation.
Yes.
And I've never been able to find anybody who could explain what was happening.
Was the noise like a crack? Like
more of a crescendo, like...
Crescendo.
Yeah.
Okay, so again, it's something touching you etherically. Like, I've been in trance states where I've seen an animal, like a dog, like a German shepherd, that came over and touched me on the knee. You know? Something somewhere is like whacking you on the head saying, wake up, bro. Wake up to yourself. You're a transdimensional angelic being. Go discover it.
So it was a wake-up call.
Three of them.
Something like that.
Oh. All right. Thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you. I think one more here. Wild card line, you're on with Wild. Hi.
Hi, Stuart. This is Larry in Fort Lauderdale. I had a quick question for you. About 2 years ago, the Institute of Noetic Sciences reported that there were some serious scientists in somewhere in the United Kingdom that supposedly were communicating with deceased people using altered television sets and radios.
I interviewed them, sir. You're absolutely correct, yes.
And I understand that they didn't want to reveal who these people were because they said they were fairly esteemed scientists and that one of their own members had passed away and then was on the other side communicating with them. Do you know anything about that? Do you know it to be true?
I believe it to be true, but I think Art would know more about it if he interviewed them.
Well, I did, and, you know, they've got recordings on tape and all kinds of wild things. Whether I believe it or not, I don't know, but it's pretty hard research they were doing. Stuart, we're out of time. Again, your favorite book, if you've got to say, go get one of my 20 books, would be?
The Infinite Self.
The Infinite Self. Well, it sure is nice having you here in the States, and when do you come back?
I'll be back in March, April, next year, probably. Thank you very much for having me on your show, Art, and good night to you.
Now, wait, in the meantime... You're going to appear in San Francisco where and when?
At the Crown Plaza at 6 o'clock tomorrow night.
Crown Plaza, yeah. 6 o'clock tomorrow night.
Yep.
Stuart, thank you.
God bless you, sir.
Good night. That's Stuart Wilde, folks, author of a book also called The Quickening. Well, as you know, we're going to gather with my house sitters in the morning, and then we are going to get on an airplane and go to Mackinac Island and the Grand Hotel, and... You'll hear about that in this next hour. This next hour is very important. That's why we're going to repeat it. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. Good night.